not looking yet.
Are you ready?
She's ready. All right. The House Committee on Revenue will come to order.
Senate Committee on Finance and Revenue will come to order. Today we have the moment we've all been waiting for, the release of the June economic and revenue forecast. So why don't we get going on that? Just for informational purposes, we're going to have a joint meeting for the purposes of the forecast, and then the House members are going to go join another committee, and the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee will continue in this room.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and just for clarity's sake, I want to let you know that while you're working on issues directly involving the current tax system, we're going to be talking about energy and cap and trade and carbon tax issues with the Committee on Energy and Environment at 10:30.
Great. We'll look forward to your report. So why don't we just get started with Tom Pokowski and Michael Kennedy.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the House and Senate Revenue Committees. For the record, my name is Tom Pokowski, State Economist with the Office of Economic Analysis. With me today is Michael Kennedy, Senior Economist with also the Office of Economic Analysis. And today we come to you to release the June 2008 forecast. With that, let me just start right into the presentation. This is a schematic that we show each time, just as a reminder of the process that we go through each quarter when we do these forecasts. We meet with our Governor's Council of Economic Advisors. Then we have our preliminary economic forecast. We then meet with a new committee group, the Department of Administrative Services Advisory Committee, which is made up of various state agencies, and then once again of the Governor's Council of Economic Advisors. Once we make the economic model and have that done, we use those variables to work into our revenue model. We meet with the revenue advisors, and then we come to you today. All right, just a quick look at the U.S. economy. What happens to the U.S. economy affects us right here in Oregon. Housing and energy are definitely slowing the economy. The worry here is, will the energy situation finally start to stick to our economy and cause us problems with further inflation? It's kind of interesting. We've had prices really going up quite rapidly of imported goods since 2002. And in fact, imported industrial commodity items, which oil is a major one, has been going up at an annualized rate of 15% faster than what the consumer price index has been rising. So part of what's going on here is that relative prices are going up, and we are starting to make adjustments to those. We see that vehicle travel miles are down, oil consumption is down in the U.S., so we're making these adjustments. And our fear, though, in our forecasting is that what is a relative price adjustment could actually start to work its way into all prices. And then once that happens, then you get the general inflation starting to go up. So far, we've dodged that bullet for the most part, but I think we're getting close to that possibility happening, and that's a risk to the forecast going forward. Households are slowing their spending. You get it's like a tax on your budget when you have to pay for high energy prices. It's not money that's really spent into your community. And we're seeing that consumers are once again then slowing their consumption of all other goods and services. Major economic indicators are pointing to further slowing. U.S. jobs have been down for the first 4 months of 2008. And the forecasting firm that we use, Global Insight, forecasts what's called a climbing W. And the idea here is that in the first half of this year, we're in a recession for the U.S. economy. But then you have the Federal Reserve that has lowered interest rates. You have the federal stimulus package that's out there for spending. And the second half gets sort of a little boost from those stimulus. But once those are done, the economy then slips back into a very slow growth situation in 2009, before finally climbing out of the full recession. So that sort of view also fits into our view of the Oregon economy. Of course, we're economists. We've got to have lots of numbers. The real GDP numbers are overall measure of economic activity. As you can see, 2008 is the very slow year. If you looked into the quarters, the expectation is that we would have negative quarters in the first half of this year. First quarter of 2008 did come out at a positive 0.9% growth, but unfortunately it came out because of two reasons. One is good, one is bad. The exports are up, and that helped the growth. But the other is that inventories are up, and those are counted as production made in a particular period. But that simply means that you're producing too many goods relative to what the demand is. All right, and then the one that we worry about, the consumer price index, and then the core consumption deflator, which is another broad measure of inflation for the economy. We worry that Global Insight here is possibly too optimistic as we're getting into 2009, because they do believe the fundamentals are there, that oil prices should start to come down. And, you know, the old saying is that if you stick to a forecast long enough, it's bound to come true. But this may not be one of those times. Next. The risk of the forecast, as you can see, the top one is a worse situation than presently underway, a double-dip recession. The first half of 2009 is not just a slow growth, but actually back into recession. They put a probability of 30% to that of occurrence. The touch-and-go is the brighter side to it, a more optimistic view. And I think the main points here, as we're looking at our own baseline forecast, the risks to the downside seemed a little bit stronger out there than risks to the upside. Okay, recent Oregon facts. We're at a 5.5% unemployment rate. It's the 10th highest for the state. That's not an unusual position for us to be in, even in somewhat good times in terms of an unemployment rate. Our lowest rate recorded most recently was in 2007 at 5%. So that unemployment rate has drifted up, reflecting the slowing in our economy. We have the 26th fastest job growth of all states. Next. Our total non-farm employment grew at a 0.9% year-over-year for the first quarter 2008. That's much, much slower than we saw in 2005. 2006 was like a 3% growth year-over-year. And then also for the first time since 2003, we had job losses, very mild job losses, though, in April and March of this year. And personal income growth. Still not bad, a little bit slower than what we saw in 06 and 07. Exports, that's one of our bright points, and you can see the very strong exports have gone up with the low value of the dollar, our trading partners, economy still doing fairly well. We've seen kind of across the board most of our sectors are doing quite well on the export side. So our position, there's lots of stuff here. I'm going to go pretty quick through this. I want to concentrate on the housing situation, especially for Oregon. Definitely we've seen foreclosures have gone up nationwide. They've also gone up in Oregon, but not quite as fast as the nation. In fact, we had the 43rd slowest rate of increase in the U.S. Oregon's foreclosure rate at 0.33%. That's half the natural average and definitely less than what I call relatively hot places to live. Florida, California, Arizona, and then not-so-hot places to live that are just having economic problems, manufacturing mostly, Ohio and Michigan. Now, depending on what measure you're looking at, Oregon still has a positive single-family house price appreciation, or it's slightly negative for the first quarter of this year. Bend and Medford definitely are negative. Of course, they also had the higher build-up and the higher price rises than other metro areas. Portland, depending on your measure, is dipping into the negative area. But once again, we were latecomers to the rise, and I think our price appreciation not quite as strong, but still pretty hefty, and our correction's not going to be as dramatic. Portland, for example, is supposedly down about 4% March over March by a measure called the Case-Shiller Index. Miami is down 25%, as an example. So I think we're in a slightly better position. One, you know, we had the urban growth boundary. I think that was a help in terms of our overbuilding. Not to say that we didn't overbuild. We did, relative to demand. But I don't think it was that great same level, as we saw in other, what I say, hot places to live in the country. Housing correction has less to adjust, as I was just saying. But residential building permits are down almost 50% in Oregon. And that's sort of matching the national average. And our months of inventory of housing is about the same. So I think what we're doing right now is we're going through that same sort of adjustment overall that the U.S. is. And since we're doing it at this fairly strong level, I think our adjustment's going to be relatively quick because we don't, in a sense, have as great adjustment to do as other places. Job growth in our first quarter was running pretty strong, 1.7%, following a fairly weak fourth quarter of 2007. As I said, the unemployment rate did drift up. And the parts of our economy that are having some real difficulties right now are definitely the wood products industry. They are exposed to what's happening nationally rather than just locally. And so they're in very, very tough situations right now. And then, of course, construction and financial activities, anything that really has a strong relationship to the housing market is where we're seeing the corrections and adjustments in our economy. Okay. And then our unemployment initial benefit claims have gone up, and that's an indication that definitely the slowing is here in our economy, and we expect that to continue through 2008 into 2009. Okay. This is our index of leading economic indicators. We use this in our tool, along with our econometric models, to give us a sense of some turning points. What do we see down the road? And as you can see, the green is the index, and there towards the right side of the graph, it's been down in the negative area. We don't necessarily think that that's as significant as a signal as being recession as it was back in 2001, but definitely is indication of slowing. And you can see that the lighter gray line is employment growth, and that does reflect. The index did lead that slowing growth of employment. All right, so here is our view going forward. As you can see, the baseline forecast has very slow growth. Looking horizontally across, employment growth of only 0.6% in 2008, 0.7% in 2009. And I want you to keep in mind, when you saw us in February, we had a notification from our National Forecasting Service that they were putting a recession into their baseline forecast. So our employment numbers didn't reflect that back then. But we did take into that account, that viewpoint, into the revenue forecast that came out in February. So this now reflects more, I think, the employment numbers, and we might have even had these employment numbers back in February, given this viewpoint of how the national economy was shifting. So keep that in mind as Michael will then go into the revenue forecast in terms of reflection of this is definitely down from our February forecast, but remember, the revenue forecast had aspects of the slower economy outlook into it. Say pessimistic, we think, is once again a more of a shallow look at a possible recession for Oregon, and optimistic just a little bit stronger, and same for personal income. So the view here overall for our economy is whether we're in recession or not, I think, is a technical definition. We are definitely slow as an economy right now. We think this slowness is going to continue out through 2008 and into the first half of 2009 with some mild growth then in the second half of 2009, better growth in 2010. But we think that with this housing problem, it's going to play out a little bit longer. And then, of course, the risks that I mentioned, one is the housing market could be deeper than we see, and then the other is the inflation front. And with that as a background, I can take a question or two on the economy, or we can move into the revenue forecast with Michael.
Okay. Questions? Okay, go ahead.
Thank you. Good morning. Chairs, members of the House and Senate committees, for the record, my name is Michael Kennedy, senior economist with the Office of Economic Analysis. And let me preface this by saying, really, that this is sort of a double take forecast, in that you will hear all of what you've heard about the economy, more cautious, maybe prolonged, whether we're going to call this a slowdown or in a recession, whatever, and then you're going to see the ultimate bottom line for the revenue forecast, which is up $100+ million. And you say, how can that be? And basically what we're going to do here is basically explain what the discrepancies are. But let me start out with something that is directly tied to the economy, corporate income tax. This is a comparison of the March forecast with actual revenues for the last 5 months. And as you can see, we're tracking fairly well, but slightly down. And where we're down is related to quarterly payments for tax year 2007, roughly. So what the bottom line here is that 2007 is a little weaker than we had in the March forecast, and commensurately, you're going to see that's going to transmit through to future tax years. Now, this chart shows the actual tax liability by tax year for corporate income tax. And as you can see, let's see if I can get this over here. Hold on, clicking the slide. You can see we're slightly down for 06 and 07. That reflects sort of that revision from recent receipts relative to those tax years. And then you see for tax year 2008, a large drop relative to the last forecast. And that's directly related to the impact of the stimulus bill. It's the bonus depreciation and 179 expensing that for tax year 2008 are estimated to have a negative $85 million impact on corporate tax liability. However, then we get the bounce back from that because there's less depreciation and expensing in the following 4 years. So you can see the general profile. Underlying this, however, there's not much change in the outlook for corporate income tax liability structurally. It's just down a few million dollars each tax year. So that's the simple part of this forecast update. Next, we'll shift to personal income tax. This is, again, a tracking of the last forecast with actual revenues for the last 5 months. For personal income tax, of course, this is always a heady exercise because it includes the April, the tax filing, and all of the refunds and payments that come in with that. Let's start, before we talk about those, let's talk about withholding. 3 months ago, three plus months ago when we met, withholding for 2008 was tracking a little below the forecast, and we talked about how the withholding tables were changed in 2007. They were actually lowered, that less withholding would be taken out of your paycheck at any given level of income, starting in 1/1/2007. And so what we had built into prior forecasts was that less withholding would come in, but that doesn't change tax liability, so additional payments and less refunds would occur in April, and that's been built into the forecast for a year and a half. Well, coming into 2008, then the question is, okay, taxpayers are going to file their tax return, they're going to complete their Oregon tax return, and a lot of them are going to go, I owe money for the first time in who knows how long. They've always gotten this refund. And so the question then is, what would they do? You know, would they march into their HR office and get out the W-4 and change their withholding parameters to raise their withholding back up so they'd get that refund, or would they just let it ride? And it makes a big difference in terms of then what you project for withholding in 08 in either case. And at that time, we didn't really have any information to sort of base what the actual response was. So what we did was actually talk to our operations in Department of Administrative Services and got the W-4 summary of W-4 parameters for state employees. It's about a 40,000-person sample, and we looked at that to see if we could actually see any sort of behavioral response. And through April, it finally looks like there's a slight behavioral response there, but not what was factored into our prior forecast. I naively believed everybody would just march into the HR office and up their withholding, and so we had withholding actually up considerably in 08, factoring in that behavioral response. If it doesn't happen, then what you see is we're tracking below the forecast, but it's not that our underlying forecast is wrong. It's the composition of payments for 2008 are going to be like 2007, lower withholding, more of a makeup in April of 2009. So,
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, it appears that Oregonians don't do what economists think they should all the time.
We're an independent lot.
And it's to their peril.
Yeah, I understand.
Madam Chair, Representative Berger, I've since been sort of apprised that it was a mistake to assume I was anything like a representative taxpayer.
I think that's my point.
Thank you. So looking there, what we're saying is that basically $10 million a month is about what the difference would be with making this behavioral assumption or not. So the current forecast has considerably less withholding. In other words, we assume from now here on out we're going to track well with the withholding, and those dollars have just been shifted to coming in February, March, and April. So nothing to worry about there, or at least we have an explanation that is not economic, not underlying labor and employment. Now for the real big story here, which is non-economic. You can see that payments for this period are $180 million above the forecast. Refunds are up 40, so the net there is still sort of a net plus to the state of about $140 million. And through some research, we've identified at least a good chunk of that attributable to some unique capital gains activity at the high end of the spectrum. So we've taken that into account. It's basically a windfall, but then you disconnect that from the underlying forecast in terms of forecasting what you think is going on, what's going to happen going forward. So it's there, but it's been taken into account. We don't mistakenly read into that things are a lot better than we think they are. These are just unique circumstances. So now to more of the broad revision in the personal income tax in line with the changing economic profile. What you see here is the current by tax year change in personal income tax liability, and then the blue is the prior forecast. You can see that 2007 is considerably higher, and part of that is attributable to those funds I referred to on the prior page. Then you can see for 2008, in part because 2007 has these funds in them, we get a very low 0.5% growth, down from what was about 2.4. Then for 2009, this is what has the most impact. We've revised down the growth to 4.2% from what was closer to about 7.5. And what that is saying is that the prior forecast assumed that we would basically turn the corner on this economic slump. You know, late 2008, early 2009, and by the end of 2009, we'd be, you know, moving along on all cylinders. That's been pushed back to three quarters, making 2009 then a mediocre year rather than a rebound year. That rebound has consequently been pushed out into 2010. The rebound isn't that strong. We have also taken into account the sunsets of the Bush tax cuts, one of which was the preferential treatment for capital gains. So assuming that those are allowed to sunset, which it looks like, and our forecast provider is now basically building into their forecast scenario that, in fact, those will sunset, historically speaking, when you see tax rate changes for capital gains, you see large behavioral responses. If they're going up, people cash in before they do. If they're going down, people wait a year, and there's almost no capital gains. Then there's a large when they do go down. So you definitely see that behavioral response, and that's what we've built into this forecast. So the bottom line.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Chair.
So if a legislature or a Congress wanted to make changes in those taxes, it would be best not to telegraph them to reduce behavioral response.
A little hard.
Chair Barnhart, that's absolutely correct. I mean, they make perfectly informed and rational decisions.
And since, as everybody has known for years, that the federal tax law bounces back to what it was earlier, was it at the end of 2010, beginning of 11, people have had a chance to do a lot of planning about when they pay their taxes and how much.
Chair Barnhart, the other issue, though, however, is if you look historically, they don't always sunset, you know, under different political regimes. And so you're really making a decision. And, in fact, the economic scenario there from way back out is sort of there's a certain probability they will, there's a certain probability they won't. You weight those together and you have, you know, your baseline forecast. But ultimately, you're going to be wrong because it's going to or it's not. So that's part of the little haziness there is if they were always sunsetting, then this would be a lot easier. But now it's becoming more inevitable with deficits, so you say, okay, likely they're going to have to allow those to sunset. But
so we can expect behavioral bumps every time a new poll comes out in the next few months?
It's your verdict.
Okay, I take it.
Now it's the number. Okay, so let's start up here at the top. Personal income tax is up $111 million, recognizing that there's anywhere from $120 to $150 new dollars in there that are unique. Really, you're looking at a slightly down forecast overall. As well, there is also the stimulus package in there for another $42 million, right? It's the increase in Oregon tax liability related to the drop in federal tax liability through the tax deduction. So really, if you factor out all those unique new items to the forecast, you'd be down, you know, maybe 30 to 50 million. And that just reflects sort of pushing off that recovery out about two, three quarters.
Okay, you're saying that we would be down 30 to 50 million if it weren't for the stimulus and for some other unique factors.
Madam Chair, yes.
We can't call a parade. Are you saying that?
In the personal income tax category. In corporate income tax, you see we're down $50 million. Note that sort of the impact of the stimulus bill on corporate income tax was estimated at $85 million. However, not all of that hits in the current biennium. Corporations are going to make the decision to invest, make these investments, and they're going to get that depreciation. But as we've seen in the past, particularly with the kicker, corporations don't revise down their quarterly payments commensurate with drops in their liability. The real impact, or some of the impact, tends to happen when they file their return and get greater refunds. So we've got $50 million of that $85 million impact is occurring here in the current biennium, and as you'll see, there's another $27 million, I think, decline in the next biennium. And then finally, other revenues are up. It's the same two that caused it to be up the last time, inheritance tax and interest earnings. Inheritance tax has accelerated, actually, in recent quarters to all-time high levels. That may be in part, you know, it's a volatile source, but that may be in part due to higher property values in estates. I mean, there's any number of explanations there. And then interest earnings, they haven't fallen off due to the kicker going out as we had expected. We modeled them on the balances, and they're still fairly well. They dried up now. We're basically zero, but there's an additional $30 million there. So the bottom line is $91 million more in revenues for this biennium. The other two factors affecting the bottom line here are in the interest expense for TANS borrowing. We've updated the projection for the cost for the second fiscal year, and because interest rates are so much lower than they were a year ago, the cost for borrowing that $750 million next fiscal year has gone down dramatically. So it's a benefit to the state of $15.2 million. And then the special session resulted in $7.7 million reduction in the appropriation figure. And so the bottom line is the ending balance projection is $143 million for the biennium, so significantly larger than the 28.8 that we had in March. Now, in terms of risks, I think they generally go along with what Tom talked about with the economic forecast, and that is if we come out of this earlier, well, things are going to be a lot better or somewhat better. If we stay in this sort of slump or further drop into recession and it lasts longer, then things could be weaker than the current forecast. Right now, looking historically at potential at how actual revenues have compared to this midpoint forecast, it is likely that actuals will fall within a band of $350 million from this forecast. This may seem odd, however, we should update where we stand relative.
Just very quickly, back to the previous point, is that based on a statistical analysis or something else?
Chair Barnhart, that's looking at the deviation around, the deviation of errors for this June forecast. So we have 12 or 13 observations by ENIA, for which we have a June forecast in the middle and what revenues ended up being. So then we look at
how the errors or how far off this June forecast was over that period of time, and then look at the standard deviation of that. So this would suggest that only in a very odd situation, and a very odd, would we fall outside of that band, outside of 350 right away of the...
Is that a 90% confidence or 65 or...
Chair Barnard, that's 95.
95. Yes. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
So now to the kicker update. It may seem odd. However, if you look at the personal, the closing session estimate for personal income taxes, non-corporate revenues, and then the 2% threshold is $241 million. Well, where we stand today is we're up 136.6 from the closing session estimate. So that means that we are roughly $105 million short of triggering a personal income tax kicker. It's not to say that it's going to happen, but just to really highlight how narrow that 2% band really is. That you can hear this economic situation, you can hear a pretty, you know, cautious revenue report, and yet here you are, all you need is, you know, recovery to occur a quarter sooner, and we probably surpass that. Corporate, on the other hand, there is absolutely no worry probably of meeting that. It's somewhat because the stimulus package was not built into the forecast. I mean, there are, you know, sort of policy issues, but we're also down considerably. So here's a sort of an out. How does the forecast look going out? You can't really see any significant changes in the aggregate numbers. So what we've done is sort of broken these out by fiscal year. Here's the change from the last forecast for each fiscal year going forward. So you can see that $144 million increase for the current fiscal year, but then down another $54 million. So for the net there, you're talking 90. That's the 91 change in personal income tax for the for general fund revenues for the biennium. Next biennium is where you really see the impact of this changing economic scenario. You're down $98 million for the first fiscal year, but then for the second fiscal year, up $106 million. And that's really this, you know, when I look at it, I say, you know, the longer you atone, the faster you rise out of purgatory. So the longer, and really, what are recessions or these pauses? They're really working off of excesses. They're working off of imbalances. To the degree you do that, you know, longer and work off more, you really built in an inherent ability for the economy then to recover and rebound. And then the final following biennium is down just slightly, about $14 million. It's really a negligible change. Now, in the past, we presented a single slide for revenue growth, and it has had both the actual growth rates and the kicker-adjusted growth rates. We've now added a new biennium, and it just got a little too crowded, so we've split it up. This is the actual general fund revenue growth. So you can see for the current biennium, 2.2% following on a 22.7% growth. However, this has $1.4 billion in distribution to the rainy day fund and the personal kicker, you know, out of it, or negatives in there. So that makes it look like it's inordinately weak, and having that reduction in there and not the following biennium makes the next biennium look inordinately strong. So when you factor out these refunds, you get, you know, a structural look at what we're predicting. And I made the stripes our recessionary, U.S. recessionary biennia, so get an idea of what was going on at those periods of time. Right now we're looking at a 9.3% growth for the current biennium, structural growth. That's actually a little stronger than structural because, again, of those one-time funds that are in there. We would be more like 8.5%. Following biennium, we have growth of 11.4% because half the biennium really is still weak before we come out of the recession, and then outer biennium are in that 12.5% to 13% range that we expect long-term growth to average going forward.
Before we go on, if you were looking at other states like the ones that you listed on your housing discussion, these kinds of numbers might be very different in those other states. Might look more like our O2 numbers. I think you've accounted for at least part of the reason why we've done better than that this time. I wonder if part of it, too, isn't that we have a more diversified economy now than we had in 2002 because of the changes that we've been working hard to try to accomplish in Oregon. Is that a part of the fact that we're still up rather than going down the way we did in 2002?
Chair Barnhart, absolutely. It was the worst of both worlds in that what was bad for the U.S. economy was doubly bad for us because of our concentration, and then our tax system was heavily reliant on those particular industries, right? It was just, you stack it all up, and we were just primed for, you know, a significant fluctuation there. If you abstract from that, you have an apportionment formula should really modulate changes in corporate income tax. These very things, more diversified economy, you know, absolutely will, you know, sort of modulate our fluctuations going forward. And then what is bad for the U.S. economy right now was providing substantial revenues for places like Arizona, for Florida. I mean, they were reaping a lot of money in 04, 05, 06, and they're facing budget situations that are very reminiscent of what we were facing in the recession for the very same reasons. You know, we're no longer the poster child for what was wrong. You know, we get to stand outside and go, just like they did to us back then.
Well, to some extent, then, this is a vindication of the policy that the state government has followed since 2002 in attempts to diversify the economy and get us out of this boom and bust kind of cycle.
Chair Barnhart, I think that's, in my mind, that's a process that's been really happening a much longer period of time. I mean, it's still continuing today, and it's helping. And I think, and it's tough in just a few years to get a really strong structural shift in your economy. I think we've always been moving in that, and we've always been moving in the diversified area, which I think is good for us. And the main difference here is that, you know, this recession, it's really got started from the housing industry. I mean, we were having the relative price adjustments in energy, and that was causing some slowing, but it was the housing that, I think, tipped it over and the financial conditions that are happening. And in 2002, we saw that as a really high-tech, extremely got hit.
Yeah.
Where they were looking at, you know, sales that were negative, you know, 20%, where now sales projections are down to the single-digit level, but they're still positive. And the export area is much stronger this time around than back then also. So those have helped us out this time around.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
And thank you. And while you're talking about the role of the housing and the fact that we're not suffering proportionately as much because our housing situation is not as bad. You know, nationally, they're still not, the economists nationally are still not certain that we've hit bottom nationally in the housing area. So do you see any downside risks? I mean, are we in a bubble, or do you see us continuing to perform much better than nationally?
Chair Burdick, I believe we'll still perform better than nationally. We're not immune to the housing downturn. To any extent that these things become much deeper than what is projected, we'll also be hurt more. But I think this time around, we're sort of floating on the top of that cycle as it goes down. If it goes down farther, we also, in absolute terms, will too. Relatively, we'll still be better off.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One thing that you've not mentioned here that I'd like you to just talk a little bit about, and that is the energy prices and the impact on Oregon's manufacture of RVs. And that, I mean, you talked about wood products, but what about this whole sector that, you know, we've...
Yes, Chair Burdick, Representative Berger, definitely that area has gotten hit. We've seen a number of layoffs coming forward from the manufacturers around the Eugene area, especially out in eastern Oregon. And, yes, it has impacted them.
As a follow-up, is it going to come back, or do you think that this is going to be...
Well, I think it will come back, but if we are now stuck at these higher prices... As long as we and what I mean by stuck, if it stays at, say, the 350 range, maybe it can drop, you know, come back to that, or between 350 and $4, because it is the relative price, and if it stays there, then slowly people make their adjustments, their behavior, and so on, and then we start to live with that price at that level.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think as incomes will continue to go up and so on and so forth, that will be an aspect where the industry, I think, will revive a little bit over time, but it won't bounce back as strongly, I don't think, as it might have in previous recessions when we would come out of it.
Okay. I think it's good to know that on the national news the other night they compared us to some European countries. And I think it's the Netherlands that has $8 a gallon gasoline.
Yeah.
So, a lot of it is what you're used to.
Yes, actually, Chair Berger, I think that's a great example of saying, you know, that, you know, in Europe, it's, I don't know how many years they've had, in conversion to our currency, you know, $4 per gallon for gasoline. And because it's been at that kind of level, they have made adjustments, and their economies operate.
Right. They have cars that get 85 miles a gallon without a specialized kind of engine.
Yes. And we will make that kind of behavioral changes, too.
If you don't mind, Madam Chair, I do have to point out that the Netherlands is not a very big country, and we have to get from here to Ontario and back, and goods and services have to get there somehow, and we don't have the infrastructure to get there except by the internal combustion engine. So
well,
we
don't have the mass transit options that they have in Europe.
Yes, and that is one of the risks to our forecast.
And our size.
Of how that translates into all, you know, everything that you buy that's transported now has a little jump in the price. I take the bus from Wilsonville. We're just facing now a 37.5% increase in our bus pass.
Madam Chair, just very briefly, in response to Representative Berger's comment, I think what that really demonstrates is the critical need for Oregon and for other states to do very good planning for long-term transportation changes as the relative cost of fuel increases as compared with the other costs. We have a lot of problems because we have not done what we need to do to increase efficiencies in transportation in terms of fuel use, and we're going to have to really move on those things and do some things that probably a few years ago we wouldn't have even contemplated.
Chair Barnhart, Tom has said this is past forecasts, but also looking long term, energy has come down, is dropped by 50% in terms of its fraction of the overall economy since the 80s to now. So those things happen, and what you say is now if those prices go up, we trigger another wave of what you're talking about, which are these responses, these technological and behavioral responses that we'll then see the impact of 10, 15, 20 years down the line.
Okay. Cool.
Moving on to the lottery, there's not really anything exciting here. The earnings are up by $9 million. Distributed between video a little bit and traditional, mostly Powerball hijack pots, as you may have seen. On the expenditure side, the increase in earnings results in slight increases in education stability fund distribution, parks and natural resources. That's about $3 million, plus an increase of $20 million appropriation that stemmed from the special session in February. So whereas we were projecting a $25.8 million ending balance as of March, we're now looking at an $11.7 million ending balance.
Madam Chair?
Representative Rosenbaum.
Thanks. I'm just dying to ask because we saw at the last forecast this spike after the kicker checks where they seemed to, the kicker checks, a lot of them went directly into the video poker machines. Are you expecting anything like that to happen with the stimulus checks?
Chair Burdick, Representative Rosenbaum. That's interesting. It was easy to identify, and it wasn't I wouldn't characterize it as a significant, it was a slight fraction, but it was noticeable to identify because we were tracking negatively, and it occurred at one point in time. You just threw this $1 billion out there. The contrast there actually is that a large fraction of that $1 billion went to the high income groups that you would not expect turned around and put any of it into a video poker machine. Whereas these stimulus checks are weighted, they're greater volume, but weighted more down at the income groups that have the tendency to avail themselves of these services.
I think what she was trying to ask you is, do you have any data on this? Did you expect any data?
Sure, verdict, no. And the problem there in isolating is because they are dribbling out over a long period of time, what I can tell you is sort of the increase therein that you see implicit in there in the video lottery really looks to be associated with the refund season, the tax refund season. And we actually worked to try to build refunds into the model, but we got state refunds, and it took me a little bit to realize what we were missing is that's a poor proxy for the bigger federal refunds, because they're much larger. And so, you know, if we were able to get those data in the model, we would probably definitely see that when those go out there, some fraction of them, very small fraction, end up in the video poker machine. But we did not build specifically anything for the stimulus checks into this forecast.
Okay. Go ahead.
I guess the other aspect there is there's going to be sort of a joint, you know, it's a joint function of the dollars, but when they come out, because people's, you know, there's a low point in the cycle during summer, i.e. people are less likely to play those during the summer. They're doing stuff out in the sun. If that's when they get their money, they might be more likely to spend it on the things they're doing at the time, and so you might see a bigger spike on things that are outdoor summer related, as opposed to the kicker went right in the middle of December. So there's probably some association there. So here's the extended forecast.
It's water.
Yeah. 0709, we're up again. We see the $9 million in revenues. Down slightly in the following biennium, and that's purely a consequence of lower consumer spending being pushed out into 09 from this forecast. We have consumer spending as a variable in the model, and that consumer spending is considerably softer now for the next year and a half in the economic model. Standard chart, where do the dollars go? You can see, again, we're going to get back up to a growth in the discretionary resources. And that's the lottery forecast. I do have one more table. It's more informational than anything. Because of sort of the concentration and the focus now on Oregon's reserve situation with the addition of the Oregon Rainy Day Fund, we've added a narrative section to the revenue section of our forecast on reserves, and then a detailed table in the back in Appendix B that looks at the outlook going forward for both the Rainy Day Fund and the Education Stability Fund, given current law and some assumptions about budgetary practices. So you get an idea of where Oregon stands to be in the event that it does not need to tap those anytime soon.
Madam Chair.
Chair Barnhart.
What are the triggered withdrawals from the Education Stability Fund?
Mr. Chair, actually what's being lumped in there are the, as you can see, they're identical, the interest distributions. It should be withdrawals / distributions. The interest in the Education Stability Fund is distributed to the Oregon Education Fund and the State Scholarship Commission. So they're dedicated. So we list them there as interest earnings within the fund, but then note that, in fact, they flow directly out on a monthly basis.
They go in, go out.
Yes. Thank you. Mm-hmm. I noted the footnote on interest, but I didn't see that it was connected with the next item. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Is that it?
For the revenue forecast.
Okay. Purchase from the committee. Awfully quiet group.
Down, but up.
Very quiet.
We do need some questions here from the Senate side, I think.
Madam Chair, I'd like to make a comment, if you don't. Gentlemen, would you characterize the difference over the last few months as basically not recession, not up, not down, but pretty much flat as you predicted? Is that how you characterize this forecast?
Chair Burdick, Representative Berger, I would. It has fit in with, I think, our forecast. We, for example, believe there's going to be very mild job loss coming into the second quarter, once the numbers are all in for the second quarter of this year. We've already seen that with April and March, but they're mild. So our view is, you know, it's when you're at this point where you get a month or two that's some job losses, you could possibly get another month that's up, and then another month that's down. So this is sort of a flat or a very, you know, if you wanted to call it recession, it's an extremely shallow one at this point. But I wouldn't put that tag on it yet.
One other question, if you wouldn't mind, Madam Chair. You mentioned unemployment. We're high compared to other states. And is that cause for concern? It concerned me. I mean, we...
Representative Berger, the concern is for us, I think, is that it's drifted up. And
right.
That's an indication that it's slowed. But for various reasons, we have almost all the time have good times and bad times, a higher unemployment rate than the U.S. average. Some of it could be related to our population growth, not being able to get people jobs fast enough as they come in, because we've also been, and during the good times, rated very high in terms of job growth. But our unemployment rate was still higher than the U.S. average. So there's a mixture of things going on, the mix of our economy, the resource base aspect. But there's also, I have to admit, some mystery. And we've talked to the Employment Department about this because we can look at Washington, and their population growth is slightly higher than ours, and their unemployment rate at times has been a whole percentage point less. Idaho has even higher population growth, and their unemployment rate is a little less. So, you know, is it just, you know, so population growth just can't answer that kind of question.
Madam Chair, one more comment on this, because this has always been worrisome to me, because and when you talked to the Employment Division and kind of looked into this sort of mystery, did you look at it geographically? Is it centered in rural Oregon? Is there, do we have an intrinsic employment problem outside of the metro areas?
Chair Burdick, Representative Berger, if you just look across historical time, if you take what we might call metropolitan regions and non-metropolitan regions, the non-metropolitan, more rural, definitely have, on average, a higher unemployment rate running through time.
Is that the case nationally?
Yes, that's generally the case nationally, yes.
Chair Brenner.
Thank you. I want to change the topic just a little bit and maybe make some comparisons between the situation we're in today and the situation in 2002. One thing that occurs to me as we are hearing this report today is that the prudence of the legislature in establishing an ending fund balance for our budget appears to have paid off in substantial ways. Your projections were down quite a bit in February, but because we had a built-in cushion, we didn't have to overreact by cutting the budget or doing some other major changes that, in retrospect, after looking at it from today, would not have been wise to do. It appears to me that we're in sort of a steady-as-you-go kind of situation, partly because we did build in a very prudent kind of ending fund balance to cushion. And it appears, based on the projection you're making, that we may even be able to meet the deposit to the rainy day fund that we put in statute last year, up to 1% of the general fund from the ending fund balance. Of course, that statute said that if we didn't have the money, we weren't going to make the deposit. But it appears as though we may actually, contrary to what we thought in February, we may actually have the money to make that deposit. So I think you probably should feel pretty good about the projections you've been making. Your new projections seem to confirm the older ones. And I think that the legislature should be pretty pleased that we were very careful in writing a budget that allowed for some movement in this time when things are kind of dicey on the national level, even though we look better here. And then one final comment, this is nothing like '02 for us, is it? It is. In '02, we met five times. to cut the budget each time, making very serious cuts in programs that the people of Oregon depend upon. This time, it looks like it's steady as you go.
Chair Barnhart, that's absolutely correct. You know, we have this income-based tax system, and it is very volatile, and it moves around crazily. The corporate alone, you know, moves 75% in a fiscal year sometimes. And the aspect that, that you have at the ending balance, in my mind, that's one of the best things you can do, because it smooths out the short run. And now you've got the Education Stability Fund, the Rainy Day Fund for longer term situations when we really have calamities that happen. I could just think it's the best thing that has happened in a long time.
And then one final comment, given the response. We're not done with the Rainy Day Fund or the other reserve accounts. I think everyone who actually follows these numbers carefully agrees that the funds that we have are not large enough to handle the kind of downturn we had in 2002. And we need to, we can be very happy with what we accomplished so far, but we're not finished with that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Good point, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Tom, if we might go back to the Global Insight assumptions on CPI, there's something intuitively hard to accept with a projection of 1.6% inflation in 2009 and 2010, given the energy environment we find ourselves in, and at least what I've been reading, you know, it's kind of it's here to stay, and its impact on the economy now trickling down to all of the various aspects of consumables. How would we get back to a 1.6 that's substantially less than what we had of 2.9 in 2007.
Chair Burdick, Senator Morris, that is one of our concerns going forward for using the Global Insight forecast. Their view, you know, the CPI, when it goes down there, it's viewing that some energy prices are going to be starting to drop. And since it includes those volatile items, that whole CPI then comes down to this 1.6. The core CPI that takes those out would still be up to 2.4 or something like that. But it's the dropping of the prices that pulls that whole measure down. So it shouldn't be a reflection of that all other goods and services are also down that low. They're still staying at a relatively higher level. They're still very good if that was the outlook. The problem with it is that, as you said, we don't know to what extent that these energy prices work their way into pushing up the prices of all items. And then the last thing that's left, the key to my mind, if inflation is going to take off, is if labor steps up and demands higher wages. And if they are given those higher wages, then you start to get into, I think, the inflationary expectations of things going higher. At the same time, I mean, what is labor to do when their real wages are going down?
They're going to ask for more.
Well, just to follow up on that, if this is wrong, I mean, what is the impact going to be on the forecast and on some of the assumptions that you've made here? This figure does kind of jump out.
Yeah, Chair Burdick, back on the slide that we had, the risks to the U.S. economy, which I think would be similar to us, you're looking at this double-dip recession, where you've had this, the top one here, where everything gets worse. You know, the home prices still go down more so than expected. Home sales are down. Construction is down. And then this higher inflation causes, in this scenario, the Federal Reserve to say, look, if the prices are going up, we can't err anymore on the side of trying to help the economy out in terms of it growing. We've got to fight the inflation front now. And that means that we'll have to let go of helping the economy grow. And so they will raise interest rates to try to clamp down, and then that'll slide us back into recession to try to rid those inflationary expectations out of the system. Mm-hmm. One thing they don't want to, they want to go back to the 70s. They want to avoid that as much as possible. And it took them almost, you know, 25 years to build back up their credibility to being able to fight inflation. So they don't want to lose that stance. So I really believe if it does look like it's translating into other prices and so on, that'll be enough to push us back into recession in 2009. That's the risk.
Senator Wessling?
Senator Morris actually asked my question with regard to the inflation number, and I guess I too would express, you know, concern over that 1.6 figure when you consider that hydrocarbon products, you know, permeate their way into everything mm-hmm. we have, do, possess, use, and utilize. Maybe just an editorial clarification. You were referring to our income-based tax structure, and you said very volatile. And while I believe that to be a true statement, isn't it fairer or more accurate to say most volatile revenue structure in the country? It's my editorial comment clarification question.
Thank you, Senator Wessling.
I figure Senator Morris and Senator Haas, you know, have some.
Chair Burdick, Senator Wessling, my colleague in Alaska would differ with you.
But they're hydrocarbon-based, commodity-based, and last I checked, I think they're doing quite well. Thank you.
Yes, now they are.
They have the mother of all rainy day funds. Senator Monroe.
Couple of points, questions. It strikes me that in this situation where you've got a kind of an economic downturn softening, businesses are still trying to keep their activities at a reasonable level, so they're reticent to raise prices based on fuel costs, transportation costs, all the things that are happening, whether it be an agricultural business or whatever kind of a business, they're all impacted by significantly higher fuel costs, especially the cost of diesel. But it strikes me that a prudent business would try to eat some of that additional cost as long as they could. Mm-hmm. And so there might be a bit of a lag between their increased costs and the increased prices that they have to charge, which impact inflation. Is that valid?
Chair Barnhart, Senator Monroe, absolutely, and particularly in light of sort of the overall corporate health, fiscal health of the last few years, this is a rash generalization. This isn't true for all firms, particularly not financial firms right now, but in a position to be able to do that relative to, say, if this were happening in 2001, when corporate balance sheets were pretty weak, they wouldn't be able to do that. But now I think they are, and that's probably one of the reasons why you can see this sort of disconnect between consumer price increases and what you know inputs are doing, which for some of us, as you've mentioned, they're going up significantly.
Well, so. My concern is that there's sort of latent inflationary pressure that hasn't been realized yet, but it's building. And I'm tracking with my colleague here, Senator Morse, that maybe those inflationary numbers are a little optimistic. I have another question, Madam Chair, about housing. We saw the numbers that came out nationally, 14% plus decline in housing values from this last quarter to a year ago. What would that number be for Oregon?
Chair Burdick, or Senator Monroe, I think the measure you're speaking to is the Chase-Shiller Index, which was released, I think, 2 days ago.
Yeah.
And they take a look at 20 metropolitan areas,
mm-hmm.
and Portland is one of the ones they look at. And it's a March-to-March look that they have. And 14% was the overall average that that composite came down. Portland Metro went down 4%. Seattle was 4.5%, as an example. Charlotte, North Carolina, was the only one that had a slight positive.
1%.
So, but once again, I think that's in Miami, it was like minus 25%.
Yeah.
Along with Las Vegas.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you for clarifying that, because we've been hearing it on the news for several days now. Any other questions? Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair. And I, obviously, you know, there's a lot of good news here and indications that I think we've been pretty prudent as a state and we're in a good position. So I guess the question, though, is that we're looking at aggregate figures, and so they don't tell the story of where you sit in this economy, which is obviously different if you're a small business person that happens to have a business where a lot of your money is leveraged into things that are energy dependent. Likewise, if you're a working family who has to tighten your belt because a lot of your income is not in savings or, you know, chucked away anywhere, it's basically going out every month. So do you have any sort of insight about, I think there are things obviously that we're already doing, but things that we might be able to do to support the businesses that are creating jobs or retaining jobs, and likewise, we don't want to have an exodus of our workforce or young people that are partaking of the investment in higher education. We want to keep those people here. So are there any long-term trends that you're seeing that might be instructive?
Chair Verduk, Representative Rosenbaum, I think, you know, definitely people at the lower income areas definitely get hurt harder by the energy situation and the food prices that have gone up. Small businesses, how do they take into account these higher energy costs that they have to face, other imported material costs that they have? I don't know specifically what a legislative group can do about these international forces that are at work. You mentioned higher ed. I always think that that's definitely your future, in a sense, if your people can get the education. It's shown that incomes are generally higher with a higher education. Those aspects are very helpful to keep going forward. You know, the person on the street only, you know, doesn't know about these aggregate, oh, Oregon's at 5.5% unemployment. They know two unemployment rates, 0% and 100%. That's the ones that are concerned. But I think the things that you are doing, you know, you've moved into areas that of technology, the Innovation Council, you know, knowing that given that our area is being known as a sustainability center, what does that mean for future businesses investigating those areas? I think those are all positive aspects. If only we knew what the next technological breakthrough would be, and we'd be ready for it, we'd be sitting pretty. But I think what we do is have an environment that is conducive to young people wanting to be here, to businesses wanting to be here, and that's, I think, the best you can hope for.
That's a big part of why we did what we did with the Betsy credit during the supplemental session. Representative Vince.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, gentlemen, I must say, my thoughts, as you've given us your explanation on the economy, are seems awfully optimistic from what I view from over on the eastern part of the state. The increase in fuel prices is having an incredibly dramatic impact on our economies over there. And I'm just curious, I think you mentioned as a percentage of our total economy, energy had dropped dramatically, but you didn't give me the number or give us the number of what part of our economy is made up of energy. I think I heard yesterday on NPR that Dow Chemical raised its prices across the board 20% yesterday, and they did so without warning to their buyers. And that would seem to play into the remarks we made about the 1.7% increase that you factored into the projections. I guess I'm just struck by the difference between what I'm seeing on the ground in eastern Oregon and what I'm hearing here today. And I'm just curious how much of an impact these high fuel prices are truly going to have, because in our part of the country, they are huge. I'm just curious if in your guys' opinion, it's understated.
Chair Burdick, Representative Benz. Yes, geographically areas, we know that various businesses are hurt much more by energy price increases than those that are not as dependent on it as part of their business. I think it, in the sense of our aggregate numbers, it probably does understate the problems in certain geographic areas and for certain businesses. As an example, the wood products industry, I know we're talking about energy, but I mean, they see the situation as the worst that they've seen almost ever. It makes 79 through 82 not look too bad. Yes, and once again, our diversified economy, wood products is an absolutely important industry for us, but the overall impact on us is much less today than it was back when it was the major industry in the economy. So for you know, here on one hand, you're getting some fairly decent agricultural prices out in eastern Oregon, but they're also being eaten away by higher energy prices. And it's kind of a, you know, boy, damn if you do, damn if you don't situation. So overall, the economy, yeah, I think our aggregate numbers, because they do tend to be dominated by Willamette Valley because of the size of the population and so on, probably do understate the rural counties situation.
Just to follow up, to go back to that, the percentage that energy plays in our Oregon economy, I know it has dropped dramatically as an overall thing, but do you guys have an idea of how much that might be?
We don't have a good specific on Oregon itself. Nationally, it used to be about 16%, I believe, of the overall economy, and now it's about 8%. And I would imagine in somewhat similarity for Oregon, but once again, if you go to certain geographic areas where energy or transportation costs are a high percentage of doing your business, then, you know, it has probably come down over time, but is now creeping back up given the prices.
Is that something that you can, data that you can get before the next forecast? Because I have a feeling we're going to be talking about this for quite some time.
Chair Burdick, we will get a hold of the Energy Department here and see what statistics they may have that can help us pin that down.
Chair Barnhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to note that Representative Vince represents a district that is the size of several eastern states put together, but has only 55,000 people in it. So his concerns may exceed those of people who represent postage stamp size districts in Portland.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
I think his point is that his district is larger than Holland.
Yes.
I'm sure
a bit larger.
I'm probably adding Belgium and Luxembourg into that, too.
Well, we're right on schedule. We've reached a point where we're going to take a break till 10:30 for the Senate committee, and the House committee is going to segue over to the Environment Committee.
That's right. And Madam Chair, the House committee will stand in recess until 10:30 when we will reconvene in hearing room F rather than here. We will not be here at 10:30. We'll be at hearing room at the other end. And with that, the House Committee is in recess.
And the House Committee is in recess till 10:30.
program area of responsibility or their subject matter expertise. So I don't know that that's done commonly in the evaluations, whether there's been that direct evaluation that this could be an appropriation instead of something working through the tax system.
Thank you.
The final requirement that each report must contain is a list of the governor's sunset recommendations. That is, those tax expenditures that are scheduled to sunset, in this case in 09-11, the governor needs to recommend whether the sunset should be allowed to happen or whether it should be extended. We had about 15 expenditures that sunset last biennium. It looks like there may be around 12 or so that will sunset in 09-11.
Okay, but not all tax expenditures obviously have sunsets.
Madam Chair, no, they don't.
And so wasn't it fairly recently that the legislature started putting sunsets in? I know we did it last session, and I believe the session before last. Is that correct, Paul?
Madam Chair, actually it goes back to reviews that started in 99 and 01. There's been a tendency to increase the number of sunsets over time. Of course, some of them have been on the books an extended period of time and they don't have never come up. But and I think, at least from my perspective, I think it's certainly partly a product of requiring this report in statute, because it was before that we really didn't have a systematic listing of what all of them are. So now it's very clear to the members, you know, what's out there, and I think that's kind of started a trend that we've seen in the last several sessions.
And then the ones that we're connected to at the federal level, have we ever disconnected from any of the federal ones?
We have, Madam Chair. I think the one that looking at Jim Craven in the back probably remembers the most is in the early 80s there was a disconnect from accelerated depreciation at the time, the fiscal stress at that time. And in the 05 session, the so-called QPI, Qualified Production Activities, deduction was the state elected not to connect to that. So there's been a number of examples.
Okay, thank you.
Okay,
go ahead.
As I mentioned, the designation of these tax expenditures by program category, this is just another way of showing how these 362 tax expenditures are distributed among groups. The first category here, the other, really are just the requirements, the few that I mentioned earlier. There's some portions of federal law that doesn't allow Oregon to tax certain items. So there are about 83 of those. And the rest are distributed in this way around the program categories that are parallel to the recommended budget. So you can see of the expenditures that are there, most of them are in the economic and community development and the natural resources area. And then they're sort of scattered in these other components. It's just another way of looking. The earlier view that you saw was the 362 distributed by which tax program they're associated with. Mm-hmm. This is how they're distributed according to the budget program. Now, we're just now beginning the process of developing the 09-11 report, and I thought I could describe a little bit about how the DOR coordinates a lot of the activity related to that report. As we're doing right now, we're identifying any kind of new, modified, or deleted expenditures. Again, at the federal level, that'll be something that we'll do throughout the summer. But there were a number of changes in 07 that I'll talk about a little bit more about how many of those were. But that's the first thing that we'll do. We will produce estimates of the revenue loss for all of these. There'll probably be over 370 of them for the 09 session. We will then gather information from agencies. As I mentioned, the subject matter specialists that will conduct the evaluations of these. They're also sources of information related to the beneficiaries and how these tax expenditures work. In fact, there are over 30 agencies that work in some way on the publication of this report. And then we will coordinate the agency evaluations. We produce some background information for the agency about how the tax expenditures work, and some guidance. There was an old Senate revenue listing of tax exemptions and how they might be evaluated. We provide that to agencies as well to help guide them in their evaluations. And then we will also coordinate the review of the material in the book by both the governor's office as well as DAS, the budget and management, which is, again, that connection with spending through the tax system. The known modifications for 0911 is that on the income tax side, again, we're really trying to line these up, but it looks like there are about 10 new income tax expenditures and about 20 that were modified. In some cases, the modifications might just be extended sunset dates or minor modifications, but there will be about 30 changes on the income tax expenditures. On the property tax side, there's 2 new property tax expenditures and 16 that have been modified. And then all of the other tax programs, there are 3 new expenditures and 8 modified. And as I mentioned earlier, a couple of those are actually now from new tax programs. The inheritance tax credit is now a new expenditure. And the construction tax, there's about 6 or 7 specific exemptions from that school district construction tax, that types of property that won't fall under the construction tax. So
when you talk about modified, that mostly means extending the sunset, correct?
Madam Chair, that's one of the pieces. There are various, like the college savings plan was expanded from a $2,000 limit to a $4,000 limit, for example. So there will be, you know, material changes beyond just the extension, but that's a certain number of them. Probably a fourth of them might be sunset extensions. There were only 15 sunsets last session, so I don't know if there were any other sunset extensions that were discussed. But if it would be useful, I could give you a preliminary list of the changes that occurred, or that were to provide some more detail of what the changes were.
That would be useful.
I'll do that.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
So the 09 focus is one of the things that we'd like to do for the 0911 report is to provide a stronger emphasis on Oregon expenditures, and that is, as I mentioned, some of these provisions of federal law don't really have the same level of if something's prohibited from federal law, that is a little bit different thing than where Oregon has made a specific policy choice to exempt property or to provide an incentive for something. And so one of the focuses that we're going to try to do is to make sure that those Oregon expenditures are as thoroughly discussed as possible. And with that, we may do less focus on the federal connects. In the case of each of these has been evaluated, again, according to whether they accomplish their purpose or whether or not they are the most fiscally effective means. And a number of the federal connects, there's a philosophical question about the actual purpose of connecting to federal law. If, as we connect to federal law, if we're actually making 111 specific decisions to connect to each one of those provisions, or if in fact we tie to federal law because it's a much easier administrative process, it's easier for taxpayers to follow the same definition of taxable income. So in terms of the evaluations, we'll probably focus a little bit less on the thorough evaluations of the federal connect provisions.
But you will still list them and give the revenue impact of them and all that.
Sure. Absolutely, and describe. What we have found is that there are a lot of users of this publication that find that resource guide very useful to describe what these provisions are. Mm-hmm. So yes, we would continue to do that. And the final focus is that I know the revenue committees have, in the 07 session, have been focusing on performance measures where available or where possible when tax expenditures have been discussed. So we will attempt to take those into account. I believe the mechanism with committee rules are to include metrics where possible in what might be useful to the committee to understand whether these are doing what they're supposed to do or not. I believe a lot of the metrics that have been put in place may not lend themselves to an 09 report, since a lot of these metrics relate to brand new, like the biomass and the biofuels credit, for example. There are a number of metrics that are laid out that the committee related to regarding the performance of this, and I don't know that any information would be available for the 09 session for that. But those are clear indicators of what the legislature is interested in, and so that will be considered as the 0911 publication was put together. So to summarize, essentially the tax expenditure report provides what I believe is probably the most comprehensive information about Oregon's tax system that exists, at least in one place. You can, by looking at all the exceptions, you can learn a considerable amount about how Oregon's tax system works. Tax expenditures are reported, again, with the budget because of this connection with direct spending. That's a theme that's sort of throughout the whole publication of the report. The report is the result of the work of over 30 agencies, and again, those purpose statements are vital in doing as good of an evaluation as possible. That's an important first step. And then finally, any feedback about the usefulness of the report would be appreciated. So with that, Madam Chair, I'm available for any questions.
Questions? Ready? Thank you. This is very helpful.
You're welcome.
Especially to me. Appreciate it.
Madam Chair.
Senator Monroe.
Yeah, when dealing with issues involving disconnecting from the Fed, you always, it's kind of like a double onus. You not only have to take on those people that benefit from the special tax treatment that the feds allow, but you also have to take on all of the auditors across the state who want to keep the tax system simple and keeping Oregon tax law and the federal tax law connected from a standpoint of simplicity is a good thing. So those are really difficult, and my experience has been only in times of dire need, severe economic downturn, does the legislature kind of have the forced to make those kinds of decisions to disconnect some major part from the federal code.
And we actually considered it this last...
We did it in the early 80s when there was a major economic downturn, I know.
Okay. Madam Chair.
Senator Morris.
For those tax expenditures that may be, I don't know, but may be suspect in terms of are they achieving their intended purpose, team up in a bill to repeal and take testimony.
Will do.
And you'll have a quick response as to whether they make sense or not.
That's correct. Any other mischievous comments here?
Well, Madam Chair, you know, your predecessor as chair felt very strongly, and I agree, anytime you're implementing any kind of new tax treatments, tax expenditures, they ought to be sunsetted in an appropriate way.
And
so if they're reviewed at least every 4 or 6 years or something like that.
And I think a very strong argument could be made to reaching back and taking a whole bunch of tax credits and putting sunsets on them.
Absolutely.
Madam Chair.
Senator Hess.
Some of these obviously are very expensive from an expenditure standpoint, and I've always marveled at the fact that if you had, say, a $200 million budget for your agency, you have to go to the Ways and Means. You're subjected to analysis and questioning. But if you have, and that applies to all agencies, hairdressers, whoever. But if you have a $200 million tax break in these expenditures, you don't have any of that scrutiny.
Right.
And that was the purpose of the report. And I think,
yes.
I think we need to, all of us, take a very good look at this report and really make our own evaluations as to whether they're accomplishing their purposes. Thank you very much. This is a good presentation. Okay, now we have some specifics that I kind of singled out. Chris Alanak will present us those. Chris doesn't have a PowerPoint on these, but we have handouts that on the material that he is presenting. Those are available back there, right, Chris?
Yeah, so
if anybody in the audience wants to follow along, it is called Additional Medical Deduction for the Elderly.
Okay. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Chris Alanak, Legislative Revenue Office. And that, the handout that the chair is referring to, it's 2 pages, double-sided. And in it are 3 tax expenditures that I was going to talk about in detail: the additional medical deduction for elderly, the long-term care credit, and home mortgage interest deduction. The first one, the additional medical deduction for the elderly, is related to the deduction for medical expenses. At the federal level, taxpayers who itemize their deductions are allowed to deduct medical expenses that exceed, to the extent that they exceed, 7.5% of their AGI. And that's available to all federal filers who itemize. At the Oregon level, the additional medical deduction for the elderly is for taxpayers who are age 62 or older. They can deduct up to that 7.5% amount if they itemize their Oregon return. So in effect, certain taxpayers age 62 and over can itemize, are able to deduct all of their medical expenses. And items that show up in here are, there are a variety of items, but they include things like contacts and glasses and dental work, insurance premiums, and prescription drugs. All of those can be deducted.
Insurance premiums?
To the extent that you pay for them, yes. Mm-hmm. And there's a very long list that the IRS puts out, to be very clear, and artificial limbs are deductible. There's a very detailed list to the extent that, and the theme there is if it's out-of-pocket money, then it's deductible. You can't deduct money. If you pay for something and then get a reimbursement, then that's not deductible. But if it's out-of-pocket money for medical expenses, medical care, it is deductible. The subtraction has been around since 1991, and it was passed in conjunction with the pension income bill and pension income credit and the ERA, the Elderly Rental Assistance Package. So it was part of this overall package back in 1991. And the first chart there, the additional medical deduction, is for tax year 2006, and it shows by income the number of claimants in income categories as well as the total amount of the deduction. And altogether, there were just under 206,000 filers that claimed the deduction for a total deduction of $675 million. And by looking at the chart there, you can see the lighter bars represent the filers, and the darker bar represents the amount of the deduction. So it's concentrated, the number of filers are concentrated at the low end, but the benefit is concentrated at the high end. And just to summarize some of those numbers, for those first three categories, for filers whose income is $30,000 or less, they represent 37% of filers and 14% of the benefit.
Okay, yeah, run that by again. For the $30,000 or less, you've got
about 37% of the filers and 14% of the benefit. Okay. And then looking at the other end of the income spectrum, for those filers whose income is $100,000 or more, just flip those numbers. You have 15% of the filers and 33% of the benefit. And so that shows the concentration of the benefit toward high-income filers.
So basically, over $200 million is going to people who make over $100,000 a year.
That's the value of the deduction. Yes.
As if we were writing them a check.
Okay?
Yeah. Well, the... I'm sorry.
Paul, what component of this, do you remember what the measure, what became Measure 28 was, on this part of that?
This was repealed, right?
The whole thing?
No, the Measure 28 had it phased out beginning at, I think, 50 16. Joint and 25 single.
I think so.
So the target, and this, we got very close to it, the target we had was to reduce the revenue impact of the current law by half. And now I think the estimate is about $100 million per biennium from the total impact on revenue. So our target was about $50 million. It probably was less, I guess, at that time because it's grown some.
Thanks.
Tell me how the phase-out worked again.
The phase-out started at 50,000 joint filers, and I think phased out to 100,000.
I think so.
50 to 100,000 for single filers, 25 to 50,000. So, as you move through that phase out, the percentage that you were allowed to deduct decreased.
Okay.
Yeah. So you were still up to 50,000 joint file, you're still able to deduct 100% of your medical expenses. But then as you got above that, that percentage phased down. You got to 100,000 joint, so you couldn't deduct anything below the 7.5%. Did not change the 7.5% federal connection piece when you're above 7.5% of AGI.
And what happened to that bill?
The voters killed it.
Well, it was also packaged with the income tax surcharge.
Oh, okay. Okay.
This was in 2002.
Along with the cigarette tax cut.
No, that was the other one.
The other one, okay. Well, Madam Chair, actually the regressivity of this is even more pronounced when you factor in those low-income elderly that don't pay taxes, but that still may have expenses out of pocket. Medical expense, in fact, probably do have medical expenses out of pocket, but don't pay taxes. So, in terms of its impact, it's really skewed toward the upper income.
Mm-hmm. And that's a good point in terms of who claims it. The deduction at the federal level, you have to itemize your federal deductions, and for Oregon, you have to itemize your Oregon deductions, but you don't have to. For this one, you don't have to itemize your federal deductions. So you can have a taxpayer whose itemized deductions are less than their federal standard deduction. So they take their federal standard deduction. But for Oregon, they essentially fill out a mock Schedule A, if you will. And if those deductions plus this one exceed the Oregon standard deduction, then they itemize their Oregon deduction.
Oh, I see.
So you don't. Taxpayers don't have to itemize both of them at the same time. It really is. All taxpayers are allowed to itemize. It's a calculation. You go through all of the allowed itemized deductions, and you compare that to your standard deduction, and then whichever is greater is what you do.
Oh, I see. So this doesn't include people who just had medical expenses, but they didn't itemize. This doesn't include those because they just took the standard deduction.
That's correct, Madam Chair, for Oregon. So they'll make that calculation. And right now, the Oregon joint standard deduction is just under $4,000. So if the only itemized deduction they had was $2,000 of medical expenses, then they're going to take the standard deduction and not directly use.
Okay.
Senator Hess. Question on these filers. Do you have an explanation, say, on those above $200,000 a year? It seems to me that a lot of them would have insurance. And so why they have those heavy amounts of out-of-pocket medical expenditures?
Madam Chair, Senator Haas, that's a good question, but this amount is any medical expenses. They could have insurance, and if you're age 62 or older and you have an artificial limb or you make modifications, you can make modifications to your home. You install a ramp, so you're in a wheelchair and you install a ramp. And to the extent that a part of those capital expenses can be deducted here, it gets a little bit complicated. Okay. But those would be medical expenses that perhaps aren't covered by insurance, but they are out of pocket. And for Oregon, if they have other itemized deductions, say they have property taxes or large home mortgage interest, and to the extent that exceeds their Oregon standard deduction, they will claim this deduction.
Well, and also if they buy their own insurance, then
yeah,
those premiums,
and if they buy their, that's correct,
are also deductible.
Right. The insurance premiums. And in terms of the magnitude of the benefit, because it is the 7.5 threshold that's in federal law, the cap, if you will, for somebody at $10,000 of income, their maximum benefit in terms of deduction is $750. That's the 7.5% of the $10,000. And somebody at $100,000 of income, they will be deducting up to $7,500. So that kind of magnifies or builds in the distribution, if you will, of the benefit. The next chart there is just the history of the deduction since 1991. And the total amount there has grown from $180 million to $675 million. And you can see the difference in the growth rates there. From 1991 through 2003, the average growth rate was just over 7%. It was about 7.3%.
And since 2003, the growth rate has been 15%. And I have another chart here in a little bit that'll get to some of those reasons. It's mainly a function of the average deduction and the number of filers who can claim it. And throughout the 90s, there was a phase-in period here. And I'll get to that in a couple slides. But part of the reason that growth was dampened throughout the 90s was a phase-in. When the bill was originally passed in 1991, the age was 58 or above, and it gradually ratcheted up to 62 and above.
But it seems to me that it would have been greater growth if the age was lower.
Yeah, I have a chart in here that will get to that.
All right.
The nature of that, the phase-in there. But the tax benefit in here from 1991, it was about $12 million a year, and in 2006, it's approaching $50 million a year, as Paul was referencing earlier. So we can see how that's grown, and we're expecting it to grow faster, in part because of the baby boomers. As they start to retire, the population that can claim this is just going to be growing, as well as other medical expenses, medical income.
Senator Monroe.
Is there any reason why we couldn't modify this statutorily?
No, this is in statute.
Yes. Yeah, I know.
If we modified it, that's how we do it.
Madam Chair, Senator Monroe, in fact, there was a House bill last session, and I have an updated number here on the next page that did just that. It was a different phase out. It phased out for higher income folks, but it was an attempt to kind of rein it in a little bit, if you will.
Okay,
so on the next page, the first chart there is the average additional medical deduction. And that the pattern here is similar to the total, in that the average growth before 2004 was 3.2% per year, and 2004 through 2006, the average was 15% per year. Some of that will be due to medical inflation. You'll also have a change in the distribution of the filers claiming the deduction. And what I mean by that is, in 2006, you have a larger share of the high-income individuals using the deduction as compared to earlier years. And specifically, in 2003, 22% of the claimants had incomes above $100,000. And in 2006, that share had risen to 32%.
Mm.
So relatively speaking, you're getting more high-income filers using the deduction. And because of the nature of it, the amount of their deduction has a higher cap because it's 7.5% of their income. So you're going to get larger deductions, at least in terms of the cap.
How do you explain that? That difference in percentage of higher income people from 2003 to 2006.
Madam Chair, the growth, their income growth. I mean, you just have a filer whose income in 2003, only 22% of the claimants had incomes of $100,000 or more, and then through income growth, cashing out, they may or may not be retired in their 60s. Mm-hmm. But they just have more income, and they're allowed to take the credit because the only requirement is the age requirement.
Okay.
So that average masks, there are two effects there that are kind of combined. The next chart there, the one in the middle of the page, the bar chart there, is the number of claimants and the annual percentage change in those number of claimants. And I have those numbers here from 1993 to 2006. I left off 91 and 92. In 91 was the first year, and the growth from 91 to 92 was 22 or 23%. And I attribute that largely to people not knowing in 91 that they could claim it and then learning about it in the subsequent year. It's a new tax expenditure. So I didn't want that to mask these trends. But what we had here, what the original bill included, was that the age in 91, 92 was 58, and then in 93, 94 was age 59. So you had these two-year increments. 95, 96, you had to be 60, and in 97, 98, 61, and then it reached its current level of age 62 and above in 1999. So, for example, in 93 and 94, the average growth, I mean, we had growth of 5% and just over 4% in those 2 years, but going from 94 to 95, the age bumped up 1 year, the age requirement. So you didn't have you didn't have the population at a certain age added to the eligibility because the age requirement moved up. So the growth there was just about 1%. So that'll be a combination of net in-migration of folks who are age 60 or above,
or people who itemized their Oregon deductions for the first time in 1995. They took the standard deduction in 94 and they itemized in 95, so new claimants. And that's that 1% growth. Now in 96, we're back up to a 6% growth, and that's because people who were age 59 in 1995 turned 60 in 1996. So everybody who was that age are new participants, if you will. So the growth rate jumped from 1% to the 6%. And then we see that same trend in 97 and 98. The age jumps in 97, so we have a growth rate of just over 1%. And then it's held steady for 1998, and we're back at growth of over 5%. So starting in 2000, we're finally at a consistent eligibility age where it's going to be 62 from now on, and that's what's in statute. There are no other changes. And so, again, we hit that 6% growth rate. And then 01, 02, and 03 were the recession years, if you will. 01 and 02, the number of filers, all incomes were down, number of filers were down, and so that led... that flowed through and had an effect on these claimants, so we had smaller growth there. But since in 04, 05, and 06, we're hitting the 6% growth rate, and that's a function largely of population growth. So that's a significant factor into why we're seeing a larger growth in the value of the deduction claim since 2004. And so we're going to have this growth, and the last forecast population numbers, the March forecast population numbers for Oregonians age 62 and above, is gradually creeping up. You know, as you all know, with the boomers approaching those ages, it's hitting for the next few years that the growth in that population is approaching 3%, and then when we get to 2011, 2012, it gets to 4%. You can see the growth growing. So on the horizon here is potential for a lot of growth in the value of this deduction. So you have a strong growth in the number of claimants and likely strong growth in the cost of medical services that would be claimed here. So those two combined, potentially, there's every reason to believe that the value of this tax expenditure moving forward is going to be much larger than what we saw in the 1990s. And that the last table there...
You might get to my question, Chris, but if you took a family or a joint filing of $200,000, mm-hmm. that did not meet the elderly deduction. They were younger. What's the difference between the tax benefit for someone that maybe is, let's pick an age, 40, and someone that's 62 making $200,000 a year? What's the benefit that we accrue to someone who's elderly, meets the elderly requirement, versus someone that does not, that is yet at a very high income level? Do you have a sense of...
Senator Morse, I'm trying to digest the question. You mean the amount of tax that we're collecting by the deduction not being allowed to people under the age?
For a joint filer, if you have an additional tax benefit because of your age, mm-hmm. and you have the same income as someone that does not meet the requirement, or the eligibility, mm-hmm. what is that relative benefit to the high-income elderly versus the high-income not elderly?
I believe it would be 7.5% mm-hmm. of what if their AGI, adjusted gross income, is 200,000, so it would be they could deduct up to 15,000 before they get over the 7.5% threshold. And then in most cases, it would be 9% of that. $15,000 would be the tax benefit for the 62-year-old versus the 61-year-old.
I guess that maybe gets at the policy issue.
It certainly does.
Yeah.
And kind of related to this, a lot of these expenses, kind of getting at the population that's under age 62 and I guess the working population, many of these expenses, a deduction or a tax-free element is available through employers who offer
cafeteria style plans or flexible spending accounts.
The difference there is with a flexible spending account, generally you have to put in your money ahead of time. Say, I'm going to spend $1,000 on medical expenses because I know I'm going to have these three procedures. And then it's a use it or lose it kind of thing. So the estimates there tend to be, on the conservative side, because you don't want to leave money on the table at the end of the year. And so I just mentioned that because it's kind of, in terms of policy, it's related in that a subset of the younger population has access in a similar way if their employer offers those kinds of benefits. For example, the eyeglasses. If you're age 62 or over and if you itemize your Oregon deductions, that's going to be tax-free for Oregon. If you're under age 62, that can be tax-free only if you or your spouse is employed and the employer offers a flexible spending account. and the last table there was again referring to House Bill 2965, which phased out the deduction. And here it was just focused on the higher income folks. So for the single filers, if their income was below $100,000, they were allowed a full deduction. And then moving in $5,000 increments up to $125,000, the percentage of that deduction decreased. So filers who had income between $100,000 and $105,000 were only allowed 80% of that deduction. And that ratcheted down until the filers reached $125,000 of income, and then the deduction was disallowed. And so you had that same phase-out schedule for the joint filers would just double those amounts. Between $200,000 and $250,000 was the phase-out range. And I updated those revenue impacts, and if that were to be in place in 2009, the revenue gain to the state would be $21 million in 2009-11 and $25 million 11-13.
I'm sure.
Senator Monroe.
On the fate of that bill?
It was in committee, the House Revenue Committee.
Did they hear it?
They did receive a hearing.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And there was some discussion about what would be done with the revenues. And in terms of policy, if the state were to implement that and collect that revenue, would it be tied to certain kinds of spending at the state?
Would a bill like that be appropriate to start in the Senate?
I don't believe so.
Okay, because it creates additional revenue, therefore it has to start in the House, even though it's really just limiting a tax expenditure. Okay, so it would have to start in the House.
Yeah, Senator, I believe it will be a bill for raising revenue.
Okay. That's what I need to know.
Madam Chair, would it therefore then be a 3/5 vote?
Oh, yes, it would.
Okay. So it would take 36 and 18. And it has to start in the House. Okay.
Well, that's the information that I had on the additional medical subtraction. Okay. So if there...
Any other questions on this one? Thank you very much, Chris.
Okay. On the next page, I just had a couple charts pertaining to the long-term care insurance credit. This is another item. I try to present similar information just so as not to jump around. And this is a more recent tax expenditure. It was created in 1999. And in 2006, there were 27,000 filers who claimed about $8 million in credits and were able to reduce their liability by just under $7 million. And this credit is, the value of the credit for individuals is 15% of the long-term care insurance premiums that they purchase up to $500. So the credit has a cap of $500. And for businesses, it's the same amount just per employee. So they can claim a credit, again, 15% of the premiums up to $500.
50 or 15?
15. Okay. 15% of the premium. Again, capped at $500. The information here is just for the individuals. On the corporate side, in the most for the most recent year that we have complete tax return information, which is 2005, there were fewer than 10 C corporations that claimed the credit, and they claimed about $4,000 in credits and had about a $2,000 tax reduction. So, most of the credit is showing up through the individual side. And again, you can see a kind of concentration comparing the low end and the high end. It's not nearly as concentrated as the elderly medical subtraction, but using those same groups that I mentioned for the medical subtraction, for filers who are less than $30,000, there are 13. They constitute 13% of the filers and 11% of the benefit. And then at the high end, filers who had $100,000 or more of income, you have 25% of the filers and 33% of the benefit. And again, you can see that in the chart comparing the light gray bars, which are the filers, to the dark gray, which are the amount of credit used. And the fact that at the high end, the used is larger, those bars are higher than the number of filers.
Tell me about the lower breakdown. It's under 40?
Under 30,000.
So 20, that from that 20 to 30K and the other two to the left of that?
Correct.
That's 11% of the?
11% of the benefit and 13% of the filers. And then at the high end, those whose income is above 100,000, it's one-third of the benefit and 25% of the filers. So there's still some concentration there.
Madam Chair, and that's because of the $500 cap. In other words, the $500 cap keeps it from being even more regressive.
That's correct, Senator. Then the second chart there just shows, I wanted to show something about getting at the benefit, because you have a credit, say everybody's claiming a $500 credit. Those at the high end are going to be able to use the full credit, and those at the low end are going to run out of liability. It's not a refundable credit.
Right.
So the solid line represents the average credit claimed, and you can see it's relatively flat, you know, hanging around in the 275 mark, and it reaches upwards of $350 on average for the high-income folks. The dashed line shows the amount that's used, and you can see for the less than $10,000 group, very little of the credit can be used. And then that inches up, as the graph shows. There's nothing inherent about this credit. I mean, I could pick any credit that has a similar cap, and you'll see the same kind of chart. The percentage used for the low income just isn't going to be that great, because to start with, when you take that, they're going to have smaller taxable income. You apply those to the rates, you're going to get a lower amount of tax that can be reduced, and everybody's eligible for the personal exemption credit.
Question.
Senator Morris.
Thank you. A question to Paul. Does the Senate have the ability, if you don't change the gross revenue impact, so it's neutral, it's tax expenditure neutral, by statute, to readjust within that those parameters, the terms of these credits?
Senator, there is some nuances around that issue, but in general, the interpretation we have had from counsel, we have very little court precedent, but from counsel is that, yes, if the bill is not a bill for raising revenue, in other words, it's revenue neutral, then there can be some revenue-raising components and some revenue-reducing components in the same bill. And this was done in the last session.
Yeah. The omnibus bill that passed out of this committee toward the end of the session did exactly that.
So we do have some ability.
Yeah.
There is some limits on that. But, for example, if you were to impose a sales tax and an offsetting income tax, there would be some questions whether that's, you know, even if it has a net revenue neutral, because of one of the terms that's used, class of taxpayers would be different. So you could argue that there is a whole class that's now getting an increase in their taxes. But in general, in terms of these kinds of modifications of credits and so forth, the interpretation we've had, as long as the bill itself is revenue neutral, then it could start in the Senate.
From a gross.
So just for instance, if we had another tax credit that we wanted to put in, then we included this, a reduction in this tax credit, and the net effect was revenue neutral, we could do it here.
Mm-hmm. Yes, but I will remind the committee that the bill from last session that the Senate modified actually did come from the House. Right. It was related to tax. It was not a bill for raising revenue as it came over from the House. but it was a general relating to taxation. And then the modifications that were done here in the Senate Revenue Committee added a major revenue raising provision and a significant offsetting number of revenue reduction. So the net was still negative.
But we did require a three-fifths vote.
It's not a three-fifths vote, no. Even though we got more than three-fifths, so we'll never, it won't be challenged because they got more than three-fifths in both chambers.
Okay, all right. You always get it when you don't need it.
I guess the last point I wanted to put on here is actually the point that Senator Monroe made. One of the reasons I wanted to include this was to show the impact on the structure of a tax expenditure on the regressive or progressive nature. The medical subtraction was a function of income, and this is just capped at a dollar amount. Okay, the last item there on the page, or the last page, is the home mortgage interest deduction. And this is an item that is in federal law to which we are tied. It was one of the, on the table that Craig showed, it was one of the federal deductions. And by tying to the definition of federal taxable income, this one automatically flows through. Just briefly, by way of history, the federal income tax was created in 1913, all consumer borrowing and all interest was deductible, and it remained that way through, generally speaking, through 1986, when that large tax reform, where much of the consumer interest became no longer deductible, but this item remained on the books in 86. So this is kind of the last piece, or perhaps the last piece, of consumer borrowing where the interest is deductible. The chart there is similar to the prior ones, and it reflects in 2006. Now, these are estimates. We don't have all of the federal information for 2006, so these are estimates that are likely to change. 560,000 filers claimed just about $5.7 billion in the home mortgage interest deduction. And this is for primary residents as well as a secondary residents. And we can see that there's still some of that concentration where it's somewhat more concentrated at the high end for the folks who are above $100,000 of income, and particularly for those that are above $200,000 of income. The second chart there shows the total mortgage interest deduction and how it's changed over time. And it's excluding the recession years of 01 through 03, it has marched up generally straight at about 6%. It'll be interesting to see once we start getting some 07 information to see if there's a spike with some of the aggressive lending that you've been hearing about and reading about over the past couple of years, if we see that in this data where there's a blip up in 2007 with more mortgage interest, kind of above trend mortgage interest claimed on the 07 returns.
Senator Morse?
Thank you. Chris, do we know what the amount of tax expenditure is for the second residence?
No. Chair Berta, Senator Morse, I haven't looked at that recently, but the office did look at that a few years ago, and I believe it was around 5% of the total was shown to be second mortgages. And I could look at that again.
Thank you. Paul helped me. I looked at this two sessions ago. It is a politically lethal issue, first of all. There is a valid argument to say, well, before we start subsidizing second homes and boats and yachts and RVs, shouldn't we do something with people who can't afford a home to begin with? I mean, if we're handing out subsidies. But, man... it is such a piece of apple pie in the eyes of taxpayers and realtors especially, mm-hmm. that it is we just had an avalanche of opposition to it, even on the high end. I think Paul helped me, and when you try to say no second homes, people can, juggle their debt in a way where they can get around that. So what we looked at was legislation to limit deductibility, home mortgage deductibility, say, I think at the time it was $20,000 or $25,000. But even that, and at the time, $25,000 in mortgage deduction would have been a loan around $350,000 at 6%. And the idea, I guess the policy would have been, okay, you're on your own after that. We'll subsidize a $350,000 loan, but you're on your own after that. But it's very tough to climb that mountain.
If I might, there's another question. I guess if we were measuring the effectiveness of this deduction, or not deduction, expenditure, if you didn't have the second residence included, would you have fewer second residences? Which there's a whole spin-off benefit of, you know, construction industry and, you know, the economic engine of those second homes. If you didn't have it, would that decrease or would it be neutral? To me, that would be the question.
Senator, the effect would be to make second homes more expensive. I mean, that would be the net effect. Mm-hmm. So you would anticipate some reduction in that market. But it's, you know, it is it's a domestic sector, so those dollars would flow somewhere else, and that would have to be part of a kind of a comprehensive analysis how that would shift resources around.
In resort areas along the coast and things might have a real impact on them.
And just following up on that, there has been a lot of discussion at the state level and federal level about changing this in different ways and different limitations that can be put on it, as Senator Haas suggested. There's also been a lot of discussion about changing it to a credit. You know, this would be at the federal level, perhaps a 15% credit, limiting second homes. That's politically fraught with political challenges. You could limit it on home equity loans. You could also reduce the caps. Again, it's in similar fashion to what Senator Haas just recommended. So, or phasing it out. So there are a lot of policy options for reducing the tax expenditure and trying to get at the impact of the tax expenditure. And really all of that kind of comes back to what you heard earlier in terms of the context of the purpose of the tax expenditure. The way it got initially into law was it was wrapped up in the whole consumer interest section, and by the time 1986 rolled around, it had become, you know, it was just ingrained. And the literature that I've seen as to whether or not the effect that it has on home ownership is not entirely clear, but then that gets at the broad nature of the current deduction. If you wanted to target it to lower income folks, you can make a credit, you could phase it out. And then again, that would target toward the lower income folks who are having more difficulty, who would arguably have more difficulty getting a home in the first place. Or you can even limit it to first-time home buyers. And if you make it a credit, then that translates into issues of the parameters of the credit. Would it be a refundable credit or non-refundable credit? Mm-hmm. And as we've seen in one of the reasons, the long-term care credit, if it's non-refundable, the low-income folks don't reap the full benefit of it. And that's why the Assembly has made the earned income credit and the working family child care credit refundable, so that more of those dollars go to the lower income folks. So that would be another policy tool. So there are plenty of options to do something with it. One of the arguments, as you know, you'll hear against it, is kind of decoupling from federal law. Right now, it's pretty straightforward. You know, if it's on the federal, well, you get it, so you don't have to do anything. But now if we do something different, whether it's a phase-out or a credit, then you have a decoupling issue. And you also have a transition period issue. You have people who just bought homes last year and banked on that deduction in terms of perhaps affording to get into a home and are counting on that deduction. And so if the law were to change right now, do you phase it in over 15 years or potential 30 years, as some loans are, or just a lot of issues along those lines?
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? Okay. Anything to add, Chris?
No, that was it.
But just so that the math is generally correct, it would appear that probably by this time that second home tax expenditure would be close to or exceeding $300 million per year. If it represents 5% of the reduction.
If that 5% held, given the Okay. That might be a little bit lower now in terms of all the aggressive lending that has been going. There might be a lot more first-time home buyers that have gotten into a home that perhaps wouldn't otherwise. So that 5% perhaps may be a little bit less, but in terms of the back of the envelope calculation, that sounds about right.
Good questions? All right. We will be in recess till 1:30.
100 million here, 100 million there. Pretty soon you're talking real money.
No.
Being the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee, we're down a couple numbers, which means that we are going to be skipping our last agenda item, which is our report on the Revenue Task Force.
Since we're all on it.
Since everybody here is on it, and everybody in the audience was there. So so we will skip on this. We'll take objections if anybody has any. So we're going to spend the rest of our meeting today talking about options for funding Oregon's reserve funds. And we have with us John Tapania from Eco Northwest. Welcome.
Thank you. For the record, I'm John Tapania. I'm a managing director of Eco Northwest, an Oregon-based economic consulting firm. I have distributed a handout that I'll move through. At Eco, we have a number of clients, and two of them in particular have been very interested in moving public policy on reserve funds for the past several years. On the front, the recent calls for expanded reserves, the Oregon Business Plan, which has been operating now for 5 years, I think has had the reserve fund on its agenda and at the top of its public finance agenda for 5 years running. I think on behalf of those folks, they would applaud you, the legislature, for having made great strides in the area over the course of the past 5 years, but also recognize that there's some more work to be done to shore up those reserves. The other group is the Chalkboard Project. In February 2006, they released a work group report that was headed up by Jim Scherzinger, former legislative revenue officer, also urging more reserves given the state's volatile tax system, and also foreshadowed, I think, what is the main issue that's left to be done. It is not so much the capacity of the existing reserve funds that you have now that is the problem. It is insufficiency of resources flowing into them. Clearly, we've gone from the point of the problem of not having them at all. We've now created sufficient capacity, and I think the last thing to do is to make sure that there are sufficient resources flowing into them so that when recessions do occur and you have fiscal downturns, that we don't have the wild swings in public services that we experienced in 2002-03. So if we turn the page, a couple of illustrative charts to illustrate what I would view to be the problem or the remaining work that needs to be done. If you look at the top panel, this is, and I put this in annual as opposed to biennial amounts. The two lines would show the blue and the red line would show a range of reserve fund balances that you might like to have in a fiscal year to protect yourself against recessions of different levels of severity. So in the blue line, the recommendation would be that you would be holding 10% of annual general fund revenue in order to protect yourself against an average recession. So if you think of all the recessions, this would be the recession at the 50th percentile. So the recommendation there would be 10%, and the blue line is then charting the 10% of your annual general fund revenue into that forecast. Now, this is the previous economic forecast, not the one that was released this morning. So these numbers will change slightly with that. The red line would be the recommendation if you were interested in protecting yourself against a severe recession, and severe would be the 90th percentile. You're not; it would be very expensive to try to protect yourself against all possible recessions. But if you were looking at the 90th percentile, then you would be looking for a fund at 25% of the annual general fund.
And I believe that the recession we had in 2002 just about meets this. I mean, it was 20%.
20%.
It was about 20, yeah.
Yeah,
right.
So we have experience with one of those.
Right. Then if we look at the green line, this is the forecast of the balances at the end of those fiscal years, those respective fiscal years of the Education Stability Fund and the Rainy Day Funds combined at the end of each of those fiscal years. So you can see where we sit right now today in fiscal year 2008. We are sort of right at that boundary of protection against an average-sized recession. That's a little misleading because you don't have full liquidity of your of the resources. There are some resources that are sitting in the Education Stability Fund that are not liquid. They're invested and cannot be immediately used. And then you also have a number of restrictions in the recently created Rainy Day Fund in terms of when the deposits are made and when they can be withdrawn that also limit your liquidity. But in terms of simply looking at the balance and the money that are the monies and the resources that are sitting there, you're sort of right at that boundary for the average recession. So and as you can see going forward, you move as you get out to 2012 to 2013 a little bit above that average recession, but it's taking you quite some time to get there. In the bottom panel, we're looking at annual savings amount, so the amount that you're putting in year by year, and again, relative to recommended levels. So again, we have two different recommended levels depending on your tastes for risk. The blue is the recommended level to protect yourself against an average recession. That the recommendation there is to put in about 2.8% of your annual general fund revenue, or an amount equal to that. And to protect yourself against a severe recession, 4.3% of annual general fund. So you can see the band there. Then you can see with the green line the projection of what you will be saving. And again, this is from the previous economic forecast that's going to brighten, hopefully, a little bit based on the numbers that came out this morning. But what you see is sort of a surge. You see the surge in 2008 with the deposit of the corporate kicker and the actions that you took in the last legislative session. Then you see years of below average payments and inflows into that fund until ultimately in 2012 there's an assumption in the Treasurer's forecast that you would have an ending balance from the 09-11 biennium that would go in and bring you back into the range. But in essence, the bottom line is here that you do have an ongoing stable source and inflow into the Education Stability Fund with the lottery resources. But when you created the Rainy Day Fund, you did have the one-time acquisition of the corporate kicker, and you have the 1% ending balance flows, but no major permanent ongoing flows into that Rainy Day Fund. And so the recommendations of the Oregon Business Plan, Chalkboard, and others is that there needs to be some additional thought about inflows into those funds, and they need to fill more quickly than they're filling now. They need to fill prior to the beginning of the next downturn, and we may be in the middle of a downturn. In terms of sort of broad thoughts about policy, first of all, as we've done here, I think it is appropriate to think of these two reserve funds as a single fund. You can name them as many different things as you want to name them. Say it's the Education Stability Fund, and this one's the Rainy Day Fund, et cetera. But in essence, they are supporting stability in the general fund. Dollars are fungible, so they should be thought of as the collective reserve fund, and the policy should be made that way. With respect to particular sources of revenue that may be good candidates, certainly ones that are worth considering are those that are volatile by their nature, because they will be growing fast during the good economic times and provide a source to save. And they will not be growing as fast during poor economic times, and therefore if you're earmarking a portion of them, they're automatically self-correcting. So candidates that would fall into that would be some share of corporate income taxes generally, not necessarily just the corporate minimum, but corporate income taxes generally. Some share of capital gains taxes, which certainly move up and down very volatilely and got us into the much of the problems of the of 2002-03 in the previous recession. There has been discussion of interest earnings that are not already otherwise dedicated, and I think Paul has some additional information on that, but interest earnings certainly ebb and flow with the economy and the revenues coming. And then, you know, politics aside, what most other, or political reality aside, what most other states would do would be looking at excess revenues or growth. We currently capture those in the kicker, personal and corporate, but both of those make strong candidates if you're looking for inflows into rainy day funds.
So you have these two scenarios. The average is 10% of the annual general fund, and the severe is 25%. What do you think would be a prudent level for us to aim for?
Well, again, I think that I would argue that is best played out in the political debate. There's going to be within your political body, there's going to be different tolerances for risk. And different interests in terms of how much protection there should be of stable public spending going forward. So the best that I can do is sort of give you objective evidence on what type of recession you'd be protecting against, and I think that's a political judgment.
Well, let me rephrase then. You've got 25% of the annual general fund. You figure 95% of the recessions would fall below
or
that.
90%.
90%.
Right.
Would fall. So what would be, say, if you wanted to protect it, say, 70% or 60%, what kind of number are we looking at between 10 and 20?
You'd be falling roughly between those, roughly in the middle of that range. So
the 10%, what is the percentage on that?
That's a 50th percentile recession.
Okay. Senator Morris.
Thank you. In 2003, we made a serious run at reforming, not repealing, but reforming the kicker, and we got something out of the Senate, but it didn't receive action in the House. And the research that we did at that time, and I don't know whether it's changed, and I've not gone back to the sources, but we had national think tanks, we had national state legislatures looking at different tax systems, and the recommendation, as I recall at that time, Paul, was 15% would be
a good number for our state and our circumstance, and that's the predication that we had on the legislation, the measures that we advanced in 03. And I don't know why that would change. We certainly not changed our tax system.
Senator, you know, prior to the 01 experience, many of the recommendations were lower, and then they read a 5-7. But I think with the 01 experience, and remember that that was the biggest fiscal impact on state governments in the post-war period. So that kind of changed that, and that's where we, I think, moved to that 15% as a recommended level. You know, if you think about the system you have now, you've got a 5% cap on your education stability fund and 7.5% on the new rainy day fund. So you're right about 12.5%. So you're kind of in between that 10 and 15% range right now. But I think the point that John is making, and that been discussed quite a bit in the advisory council for the revenue restructuring task force, is, you know, if you can set a capacity anywhere you want, and if we get there in the year 2100, it doesn't do much good. The key is kind of that flow and rate of revenue stream into the fund itself. So that's an issue I think that's really kind of come more to the fore in this interim than we've talked about in the past.
And it's especially important because none of these scenarios account for the fact that we may be drawing on the fund.
Absolutely.
In fact, right quick here.
Yes. No,
so that's another argument for that. Senator Morris.
I mean, the other reflection, John, on your graph on the actual and proposed would lead one to believe that current law, the green line, would be adequate. And I think that's that the graph, is first blush, is a little misleading.
The one on the top or the one on the bottom?
The one on the top.
One on the top. Well, again, I think there's a couple of points to be made on that front. You are right at that boundary of protecting yourself against an average recession and all of your resources in that fund are not liquid. So this chart is a little misleading in that respect, in that if you did have an average recession and you wanted to protect yourself against it today, you wouldn't have the resources in this upcoming biennium to do it because you couldn't, you wouldn't have access to all those resources you see on that green line.
What assumption did you make, if I may, Chair? What assumption did you make in terms of the rainy day fund contribution to building that reserve fund?
I took the treasurer's forecast from the previous economic forecast. So
my point is that when it's an ending fund balance, that's 1%. History, at least as I look at the history of budgets, the ending fund balance has been almost, you know, has been very, very small. The ability to set aside a meaningful ending fund balance. And we did. We tried. I think we did a fairly good job.
It's a good thing we did, too.
Yeah. But also we witnessed, you know, the trailing effects of initiatives and the pressure that brings to bear when you get a bump in revenue to put it back into programs because you've cut them so deeply, you know, over the past several bienniums. So the ability to take monies out of an ending fund balance, I think, is highly speculative because in most cases I think that ending fund balance is going to be very small.
Yeah, I would agree. And the numbers here, again, they're from the last forecast. They were very pessimistic about the amount that would be of the ending fund balance for that would come out of this biennium, and that's reflected in these numbers. They're a little more optimistic. They're assuming that there would be a 1% ending fund balance at the end of the next biennium, and so that's why you see that bump in 2012. But I would agree that that source, and the way that it's operating now is not as certainly not as reliable as the source that you have going into the Education Stability Fund.
Can you think of a more stable methodology we could use instead of ending fund balance?
Well, much like you do with the lottery, earmarking some percentage of an existing revenue source and dedicating it as a upfront is certainly more reliable than what you're doing now with the ending fund balance. And again, the lottery is a perfectly good vehicle for that. That is a little bit more stable than others. But I would also recommend thinking about earmarking portions of volatile revenue streams, because again, they're operating in exactly the way that you would want to be saving. They are surging during periods of strong economic times when you have the ability to save, and they're contracting during weak economic times when you don't have the ability to save or less of an ability to save. So again, the corporate income tax, capital gains, interest on the general fund, or more permanent policies around one or both of the kickers all fall into that category.
Senator Monroe.
And the proposal to change the way we do forecasting would actually get at that. You've seen the proposal.
Yes.
You forecast a range from minus one standard deviation to plus one standard deviation. You budget in the middle, and any revenue that comes in excess of your budget level up to that one standard deviation is captured and put into the rainy day fund. That would be a bump in the corporate or a bump in the personal, or you know, those volatile revenues that the forecast failed to show, but that came in as happened a year ago, and you grab a big chunk of that money and put it in your rainy day fund. In essence, that would be doing what you've suggested, and is capturing some of those volatile revenues when they actually blip up.
Absolutely. Now that's right in line with that.
And it can be done without a two-thirds vote, which is what is required to do anything with the kicker. Two-thirds of vote of both houses. Very difficult to get.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you very much. We appreciate it.
Madam Chair, the material I have really kind of follows up on what John has talked about and addresses Senator Monroe's comment about the forecast methodology. Mm-hmm. So if I can go through that real quickly,
sure.
And then whatever questions you have on that. I had your packets. I did go ahead and make a copy out of the forecast document, and Michael did include this in his presentation, but we're happy to see, and this really came at the suggestion of the Treasury, because they've been getting a lot of questions on the bond rating meetings about the state reserve position. So we'll have this as a regular quarterly piece that we can track the reserve funds better in the future, or at least people, I think, will be a lot more aware. The next page I have is it's called Reserve Fund Revenue Sources. And I just modified Michael's table a little bit. I took the beginning balance going into 07 and 09 and then looked at the flows into the fund to get at this rate of flow as a percentage. And then the advisory council for the task force was looking at developing a recommendation around a 3-4% replacement rate. So if you look at 07-09, and, you know, I've taken 90% of the lottery contribution to the stability fund, so I've taken out the Oregon Growth Account. And then, of course, you get $341 million for the RDF, which is the corporate kicker plus the interest earnings, which are retained within the fund, unlike the ESF. You get 3.7%. So you're up there, you're within that range. But then, of course, you drop below, and this is assuming that 1% allocation is made after the biennium for the ending balance, you're down about 2.5%. So what you're looking at there would be you know, for example, 09-11, you got about $400 million going into the fund. You're looking at, to get in that 3 to 4% range, you know, another $100 to $150 million to get up to that 3 and say 3.5%. So that gives you kind of a ballpark sense of kind of, and that would get at John's 90% line is where that 3 to 4% comes from. So to try to move you toward that line in terms of
which line is that?
This would be
the red line.
Yes. Well, the 4.3% of annual general fund would be for the severe recession line.
Right.
So the 3 to 4 would get you up toward that line.
Okay.
So 4.3 would be at the top of that line. If you're at 4%, you'd be fairly close. So that's kind of the range that the task force is looking at. The advisory council is going to make some specific recommendations for the task force itself. So I think we'll see something come for the 09 session.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, the hard part of that is where do you get the revenue from? And I've just listed there things that have been discussed, and John mentioned several of them. The governor's proposed looking at a corporate minimum and depositing it directly in the revenue fund into the reserve fund. The ending balance deposit, there's ways to deal with that. There's the earmarking allocation up front rather than waiting after the biennium. So there's been discussion around modifying that. Redirecting a portion of the kicker refund or credit all. We've talked about capping the refund, modifying the corporate or directing all of the corporate on a permanent basis. The volatile revenue sources that John mentioned. And then the last two was the one I wanted to talk about quickly with you, and that is redirect general fund interest earnings. And I did go ahead and make a copy of Senate Bill 817. This committee approved, actually, last session, and the floor, and then with some discussion primarily with the budget folks and concerned about the potential impact in the budget process, the decision was made to hold off on Senate Bill 817. The advantage of 817, at least from my standpoint, is it's very simple. Now, if you look at Section 4 of the bill on page 2, current law under Section 4B, under current law, all interest received on deposits of money under this subsection shall accrue to and become part of the general fund. In other words, a default, change that to rainy day fund as a simple, elegant way to redirect those earnings.
And how much money are we talking about here, Paul?
If you look on the chart, general fund interest earnings, which should be in your packet somewhere in there. I think it's, here it is right here.
Oh, here we go.
It's called general fund interest earnings.
$9 million.
Nice packet change.
So you can see the other thing that that's interesting about this is you notice those biennia in which we exceed the forecast by a large amount, we have large interest earnings. For example, look at the 95-97 biennium. We exceeded the forecast by $771 million in that right column, and we had our highest interest earnings of this entire period, $136 million. And, of course, there's a logic there. If we're collecting more money than we're budgeting, where's it going? Well, it's sitting in idle balances.
Mm-hmm.
So they're generating interest earnings. So the Treasury is able to generate more interest earnings when revenue exceeds the forecast.
So then would you offset it by the amount of interest we have to pay to borrow the money to send out the kicker? How would that work?
Well, one thing to keep in mind about the rainy day fund is that the way you constructed it last session is, unlike the Education Stability Fund, it retains its interest earnings, but it's also part of the general fund. So the Treasury is able to use those cash balances to reduce their interest costs over time. So what we're hoping is that that'll end up reducing, for example, the TANS costs which you saw. The estimate was reduced today, but it's still $45 million. So it's still a big cost to the general fund. Now, there's the also, and that's where we get into this issue about the kicker. When you have a kicker, you affect your cash flow, and therefore you're going to have to borrow externally more because your money isn't going to come in until later. So this, anything that would generate a larger rainy day fund will help reduce those external borrowing costs because you're going to be able to use the cash in that rainy day fund. You can't budget it, but you can use it for cash flow purposes. The other thing I'd point out, too, you look at the down years, 01, 03, where the forecast deviation was about $1.7 billion, we had very low interest earnings. And the same thing is true of 03, 05, we're $300 million below forecast. We generate only $30 million, less than half our average for that period. So, and then this last biennium, we had $100 million because we had excess revenue coming in. So there is a real link there. And so, and that gives you a sense, over time, this period I looked at, the average was about $68 million. So if you want to use that, we would use something like that as a revenue estimate for you that would be flowing into the fund. So about $70 million per biennium, which would get you probably about halfway to that 3 to 4% target. And you can see long term that the estimate is $59 million. That's just, we know that that's going to, the forecasters don't know how much their actuals are going to deviate from their forecast. So that's 817, and that bill was developed last session and in conjunction with Treasury and the cash flow folks. The other bill was what Senator Monroe mentioned, has been talked about by the task force of Senate Bill 26, which Senator Schrader introduced last time. And that's just where you would go in and have a methodology for your kicker refund calculation and corporate credit calculation that will be different than your budgeted amount. You would budget to your baseline estimate, your current estimate you received today, for example, that would be your budgeted revenue. And then you would make a calculation historically based on what's been the average deviation. And this would be a policy choice. How much of a deviation do you want to go above that median point and say this is the point in which anything between the amount above the median and the median itself is the deposit in the reserve fund. So if you look at a chart, it's called Revenue Forecast History, Actual Revenue Above Standard Deviation in there. So I went back and looked at the forecast back through 89-91 on up through 05-07. And you can see, for example, and I did the kicker calculations. Remember that the personal kicker is not just personal income taxes. It's everything but corporate income taxes. So it includes interest earnings. It includes estate taxes. It includes everything except corporate income taxes. You can see the average deviation was about 1.7%. So, in general, and that depends on which year you pick, to end it, we had this real high above deviation, why we're above, but over time, it's pretty much unbiased. The forecasters do a good job of providing you with unbiased estimates, but there's a lot of variation around that, either way, up or down. And the variation measured by the standard deviation is 6.2%. Now, the corporate, you can see, is even higher at 36%. So that would be one measure. There's not anything magical about using one standard deviation. You can use half a standard deviation, you can use two standard deviations. But my only suggestion is if you go down the path of Senate Bill 26, that you make sure it's a mechanical calculation that everybody understands and there's no judgment involved. Yes. That way you help protect the integrity of the forecast process. But you can see if I just pick the one standard deviation, if you look at the mid-90s, in 93-95, corporate was above, and then in 95-97 it was above, and personal was above too. Of course, this was the period when the economy in 96-97 we had the strongest growth rate in the country. 05-07, of course, we saw our biggest kicker calculations, and you'd still have about $400 million above that one standard deviation that would go out in a refund under this proposal. But you'd also have a very large rainy day fund deposit of $671 million plus the $180 for the corporate. Of course, you ended up doing all the corporate, but this would be the amount above the one standard deviation. So you can see the deposits there would be substantial over time. There probably wouldn't have been any withdrawals in this period of the 90s until you got to 0103. So you would have had, you know, close to $1 billion. You've had over $1 billion from these deposits during that period of time.
And that would not include the education stability fund.
This would be separate completely from the education stability fund. This would just be the additional. This would be if you had a scheme like this established in the 90s and historically using one standard deviation, those are the deposits you'd be making into a rainy day fund.
Makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
So the other thing that, you know, I can do is look at some different time periods and that kind of thing as well. But I think that gives you a feel kind of where what it would look like, and you would have some, you know, some policy levers to change this in terms of what's the level that you'd want for that range and that kind of thing.
And of course, the bigger the rainy day fund is, the more money we have to offset interest costs, so you mm-hmm. get savings from that as well.
Yes. The interest earnings, you would have an indirect effect on the kicker calculation because the interest earnings are part of the general fund and therefore part of the kicker calculation. So when you exceed the forecast for interest earnings, and of course you do during those periods when everything else is above forecast, it tends to increase the size of the kicker. Mm-hmm. But if you were to pull it out, it wouldn't be part of the close of session estimate because it's not general fund, and it wouldn't be part of the error either to go into it. So it would, in a sense, it would dampen the fluctuations of the general fund because you're pulling out an element that fluctuates a lot.
And that would be statutory, so in a severe downturn, you know, we could by statute use the, of course it wouldn't be much interest earning in a severe downturn. So. I'd like to do both of those things.
Senator, the idea would be, yeah, you would be putting depositing money during periods like last biennium when you've got more than you expect,
yeah.
and your interest earnings would
yeah.
be up. And during the periods when you would want to be withdrawing, you wouldn't be putting much in anyway. Right. So it does have kind of that cyclical. It's as John was describing, the volatile revenue sources that when times are good, you take them, and when they're not, then they're going to go down. You would have that kind of automatic stabilizing effect.
Well, if this had been in effect in the 05-07, we would take the interest first, substantial interest, put it in the rainy day fund, and then we calculated a standard deviation above the median forecast and capture everything up to that and put it in the rainy day fund, and then the folks would still get a substantial kicker.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Sounds good.
I'm there.
Will you anticipate the advisory council actually modeling comprehensively, if we look at the education stability fund, those contributions? They're pretty much guaranteed. Coming out of the lottery, mm-hmm. factor in the standard deviation model and the interest, those excess interest earnings, and then see where they cap out. I could see us raising the education stability fund to 7.5% and then cap the general fund, mm-hmm. rainy day fund, at 7.5% or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And see how that would model out historically and over time.
Mm-hmm. I have some requests to look at some, you know, the ending balance calculation historically and do some other things. So I'll put all that together, and of course you'll get that as members of the task force, but I'll also make sure that the entire revenue committee gets that. One of the things that's kind of an interesting disconnect is you really have a stronger revenue source flowing into the education stability fund than you do in the rainy day fund long term. And the rainy day fund, though, has a bigger cap. It has a higher cap.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you have the stronger source going into the fund with a lower cap. So there is a little bit of a disconnect there if you look out over time. The other thing that we do think will happen eventually, though, with the Education Stability Fund, and we're seeing it now, and we talk with the forecasters about this a lot, you know, we've seen, you know, 15-20% annual growth in the video lottery because of the line games. That's stabilizing out in the 4-5% range, so that we think eventually lottery revenue will grow more slowly than the general fund.
Oh.
So that means you won't be catching that cap.
But it's less volatile.
Less volatile. More stable, but slower growth than the general fund. And we think income taxes long term are going to continue to grow a little bit faster than income. But we think that lottery is more closely tied to consumption, which grows a little bit more slowly than income.
Hmm. Okay. So we'll get a spike when we put out a kicker.
Well, at the very least, our target ought to be to get to the 15% level. And you know, I could even see going to 10% on the Education Stability Fund and maybe 7.5% on the rainy day. Get us to a possible maximum of up to 17.5. I don't think that would be excessive, but you know, we need to start somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Again, and keep in mind that's a key issue, but another key issue is how fast you get there.
So yeah. It's that, oh, yeah.
How much you're putting in each biennium
becomes
critical, because we anticipate that most of the time with those caps, you're probably not going to get to them. If we have business cycles every 5 to 6 years, many times you will never get there.
That's what I'm suggesting. If we model it, understand where we've been, and then perpetuate that in the future and see what how we need to, which level we need to pull.
In terms of infusions in the rainy day fund, there has to be something every biennium that goes into it, and that's why capturing the interest makes sense and be more in the better times, but every biennium there would be some significant amount of money going into that rainy day fund. And then in addition, if you, by this other refocusing mechanism, capture substantial amounts of money when we exceed forecast dramatically, then that does what has been suggested, and that is captures the money during the good times to be used during the bad times, which any good businessman does.
Yes.
All right. On that note, Paul, did you have anything else?
On your last item that we're not going to talk about, I did include the short-term options list for the Revenue Restructuring Task Force, so you'll have another copy of that. Okay. And the task force will be talking about the long-term options at their June meeting.
Yeah. Okay. Comments, opinions, predictions, prognostications for the good of the order? My two committee members?
In the next two meetings, or the second and third meeting schedule, we'll get those out, dates, so we'll get them on the calendar.
Yes. Oh, yeah. That's. I wanted to try to aim for the week of September 22nd for our next meeting.
And Thursday would be what, the 25th?
Yeah.
That'd be a good day, I think.
Shall I?
And that will be a tigered meeting. And I'm thinking now we'll probably do it during the day, but I'm open if people want to do an evening meeting.
I'm a little hesitant, Senator, on that 25th, because I think the task force meets on Thursdays, so I'll have to check that.
Okay, check and make sure.
It doesn't have to be on Thursday for my account.
Yeah.
Tuesday or Wednesday would work. I'd like to stay working Mondays and Fridays if possible.
Okay, let's try for one of those 3 days. And then our next meeting after that will be in November, and that will be for bill introductions and a couple of other things that we have on our agenda. So we'll get that specific dates out as quickly as we can.
Good. Thank you.
So with that, we are adjourned.